Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 64 of Dominaria's Judgment, a weekly constructed magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And this week, we're kind of doing a little bit of everything. We have the team open in Baltimore coming up this weekend, so you have to, if you want to win that tournament, you're going to have to master at least two, ideally three, of Pioneer, Modern, and Legacy. And even though Modern is our regular beat and we dip our toes into Pioneer every now and then, we thought this would be a nice occasion to just kind of take a broad picture view of just constructed magic as a whole and see what's going on there.
Yeah, there are three actual constructed formats being played at this event. Despite everyone's insistence that Legacy and Standard are not formats, one of them has been selected. And it seems like here, at least, you have been doing a bit more Legacy than I have, and there's a little bit more to talk about than it seems like there might be on the surface.
Yeah, I have been playing a decent amount of Vintage, which sadly, or maybe not so sadly, is not one of the formats on the docket for this team event. And then there is Standard, which I know we covered the death of Standard and what that meant for Magic as a whole a while back. And it seems like rumors of its death may have been like very slightly exaggerated insofar as I think the second Pro Tour, so the one after the upcoming one, is slated to be Standard. I think that has been officially announced. And in theory, at this point, you can run RCQs in the Standard format, and I imagine with the Standard Pro Tour coming up, maybe there will be this larger push from top down to try and support Standard in paper again. For now, though, if I see news of a Standard RCQ, I assume some kind of scam is afoot here, because why would you do that to yourself and to your store when no one wants to do that, and you could probably get a much better audience running a Pioneer or Modern, or maybe even Sealed instead.
This is what happens when you're, like, trying to run your RCQ with eight of your friends out of, like, your basement on a Thursday night or something, and you advertise it as Standard so no one shows up, and, you know, you're hiding it, like, in the warehouse district so that they can't find the right shipping container. This is really just how they get it over. You know, tournament fraud these days, a little more sophisticated.
I mean, that is a literal example of a thing that has happened several times and which has been plastered over social media. So I don't know how sophisticated that particular scam is, but I guess it's good enough if those results are going to be accepted. Anyhow, we have some results that are on the level to get through at the top here. As always, going to go over the Modern results from the weekend. And not too much to get to. This is going to be a pretty brief segment because there were only a few tournaments and nothing too notable really happened in either one of them.
Yeah, I mean, these are largely decks that we would expect to be winning in Modern. Well, you know, maybe a little bit beyond that. But, you know, a lot of Murktide, a lot of four-color, a Calibrated Blast in first place.
Yeah, so I don't want to bury the lead there. We did have a challenge being taken down by Calibrated Blast, which would be a big headline in itself. Maybe less so now that we've seen similar results happen a few times at this point. And so it's almost good news in a way for that deck that it winning is not some like cataclysmic event, but also I almost missed the days when this could take us by surprise and it wasn't just an actual like thing you could expect at this point.
Yeah, it's almost a like referendum on the status of four color that this deck is doing well, more so than how good it is, because I think of the major a referendum on four color, which it did beat in the finals of this event, but also a referendum on the status of Living End and Rhinos. Because the two poles of this deck's matchups are beating up on 4-color because 4-color doesn't do anything to stop you from killing them, and then losing horrifically to the decks with Force of Negation. And it's a pretty big downswing for those decks, and I don't know like if it's a really good time for 4-color, but it feels like the deck's results and like the players playing it are chicken-egg here with, like, if all the best players are playing 4-color and 4-color is winning, is it because all the best players are playing it? Or, like, are the best players playing 4-color because they actually think it's the best deck? I don't know what to say, but it is just a lot of good people winning with 4-color these days.
Yeah, I still don't know exactly where I come down on that question, but I think one development recently that has really encouraged that is Daryl Ayres, who is one of the minds behind refining the Traverse version of 4-color, published this incredibly extensive living document, if you like, this guide to the deck, complete with sideboard guide and any kind of detail you could ask for. At what is a relatively hefty price point for Magic content, I think it's $20 straight up or the equivalent in, you know, virtual Magic Online currency. But I almost think that in a world where there is so much Magic content and a lot of it is it's pay-to-play in the sense that, you know, you have to chip in $5 to somebody's Patreon, but once you do, you're kind of whelmed, I guess, but by what you find there. There is a market, I think, for stuff which comes in at a higher price point, but which you know, like, you can take to the bank that it is extensive and that you're getting your money's worth. And if you take this to a tournament, I think knowing the ins and outs and having that kind of expert guidance is very helpful. And if, you know, this 30-something page primer gets you one more win and that win helps you cash, you've already paid for your investment there several times over and now potentially have these lessons that you can carry forward there as well.
Yeah, I think that the living document part of it is the important part, because I think that there's a lot of, like, static list or, like, I don't, you know, a lot of, like, it goes out on a specific day and, like, this is, I know at least with my content, like, this is a, you know, I'm putting out a bunch of deck guides, but, like, my Is It deck guide from, like, 3 weeks ago is, like, a little out of date to what I would play today. And I know that going back through and updating those is part of what I'll probably be doing in the near future. But, like, having someone who is has a living document that is updating it regularly and not just, like, you know, Wednesday at 9 p.m. before the tournament or whatever, I think that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, so in this top eight, you had 3 4-color decks, including 1 Traverse list that I think was loosely modeled on Daryl's list, and then Gore Ducat, Daniel Gertschel, playing just the exact Daryl list, and he shouted out that document in his tweet. And then we also had a more conventional, I guess, 4-color elemental deck. So a great day for 4-color over here, which, as you flagged up, means a good day for Calibrated Blast. Beyond that, it's kind of more of the same. A lot of Hammer, a lot of Murktide. In this top 32, like if you look at Bamzing's data breakdown from the event, Hammer actually, for once, has edged out Murktide as the most popular deck, but a lot of those results are clustered towards the bottom of that top 32. They're in the 4 and 3 range. So even though you have X-Rail making his return to Hammer and to the Modern Challenge top 8, you know, with the deck that he's known for the most part, Hammer's success is something that we talk about more on Sunday here rather than Saturday.
Yeah, and I think this, like, a million Hammer decks, but all of them are in, like, 17th through 32nd place, has happened before and is just sort of a sign of, like, other deck sideboards catching up or, like, specific matchups showing up that are not super ideal. I know we talked about a lot of creativity last week. It didn't have the best weekend this week in terms of, like, tallying results, but it did finish in 9th both challenges, and that is a notably tough matchup with, you know, I guess, you know, the list in 9th place on Saturday only has 1 Prismari Command, but, like, in general, there's just a lot of stuff in that matchup that lines up pretty poorly for Hammer, and, like, there's a few other things in the metagame that are going down a similar route.
Yeah, I get the impulse to break down the top 32 data, because that's what we get from Wizards. You know, they publish a top 32, and then you can do with that what you will. But I wonder if it would be more useful in a way to just look at the decks that went, let's say, X2 or better, because I don't know how much of this is mathematical versus psychological, but when I look towards the bottom end of these results, I tend to place a lot more weight on the decks that went 5-2 versus the decks that went 4-3, where, you know, you go 4-3 in a tournament, you don't feel especially good, it's not a bad record, not a great one. You go 5-2, you think, okay, if this one thing had gone differently, then I would be towards the top of the standings in contention for the top cut. So I don't know if that's just a personal thing, but I feel like that's a pretty common response and something to keep in mind if you're doing that kind of data analysis yourself.
I mean, if you just think about it in terms of coin flips, like, the decks that are 1 failed coin flip outside the top 8 are likely more impressive than the decks that are 2, because that's twice as many events that, like, you know, twice as many unlikely events that went your way. Like, the 5-2 decks are a coin flip away from top 8ing or a coin flip away from 4-3. You know, if you said the 4-3 decks were 2 coin flips away from top 8, they were also 2 coin flips away from being 2-5, which is a deck that you should throw right in the digital garbage.
Yeah, I guess they are also 1 coin flip away from being the 5-2 deck that I'm taking more seriously, even though it's 1 minor event away from being in a different bracket instead. So always, like, weird decisions to make on the margins there. But that'll do it, I think, for the Saturday challenge. And then moving on to Sunday, this almost feels like a Modern challenge from a year ago, because this is Hammer versus Murktide at the top tables, and everything else is kind of on the outside looking in here.
Yeah, I mean, we did have a notable streamer, Young Dingo, in second place with a deck that was neither of those. Rakdos Scam, or, you know, Rakdos Evoke, whatever you want to call it, which is kind of interesting to me. That is not a deck I would want to pilot into a bunch of, is it? My experience with that deck is actually that just, like, that is a hugely problematic matchup. But it's also extremely powerful, and, you know, a billion Furies is a fine place to be against Hammer. You're a main deck Dothi Voidwalker deck if anyone tries to beat the Hammer decks and Izzet decks with Yawgmoth. So there are some pretty good aspects of it. I just, when Izzet is the best deck, I really cannot talk myself into playing that deck.
Yeah, I described it in my article this week, which is essentially the same premise as this podcast, just covering each of Pioneer, Modern, and Legacy ahead of the Open in Baltimore. I described it as essentially the go-to Fair Thoughtseize deck now that Death Shadow is a little bit on the decline and a lot of those players have moved back to Murktide. But now that I think about it, this is not a fair deck by any description. This is almost more reminiscent of the kind of like the mono red prison decks or something in Legacy, where my entire deck is just a sock full of pennies dedicated to a different opponent, and I'm just going to show up with whichever one is appropriate for the matchup. So yeah, if I'm paired against Living End, then my main deck Dothi Voidwalkers, and you know, my Blood Moons are going to do some good work, and then in the sideboard I've got my Chalice of the Void and my Unlicensed Hearses to go with all of my discard spells and my evoke creatures and so on. And then yeah, if I get paired against, you know, Amulet Titan or something, well, again, I'm a main deck Blood Moon deck, and sometimes I get to do the Thoughtseize Dothi Voidwalker thing, and then sometimes I'm gonna get two grief triggers in the first turn. And even if none of my like one hit KOs are appropriate in the given matchup, then I can still just hit the top of my range with you know, grief or fury plus Undying Malice, and that 1-2 punch hopefully will be enough to carry the day. So and you're backing all of that up with some cards that tie the room together. I guess Ragavan is a good example, but also Seasoned Pyromancer and Fable of the Mirror Breaker. But I think it's better to look at this more of like a combo prison deck than as the kind of the heir apparent to Jund or anything like that.
Yeah, that all sounds right to me, with a single exception that I think that this deck has a little more staying power than like a prison deck, because it's sort of like, I don't know what the right equivalent for like what the grief part of like the evoke combo is. Maybe it's like Undying Malice is your Ancient Tomb and grief is your like Chalice of the Void, but like you just have this endgame where like even if you flood out, you just get to cast your griefs and furies from hand, very much in the same way that the four color deck operates. And I think that is very important when you are playing against decks that are not as laser focused as, you know, Izzet is, in terms of just like having a pile of good cards. Like when you play against other somewhat disruptive decks or mid-range decks, that comes up a lot. I just like, the Izzet deck is just too good at what it does to really like lean into that. Like it's already like, they're trying to play this game against four color all day, like, and you're just largely a worse version of that. So they're just really well set up to beat up on you. I did click through to Young Dingo's tweet about getting second in the challenge. I will read the sentence that he describes this. I could say something inspirational about the deck, but instead I will just tell you to buy a bidet if you don't have one. It will improve your life significantly more than anything else I can say in this tweet. I don't know if that reflects well or poorly on Rakdos Scam, but that is in fact what has been said on the record.
Yeah, not sure if I meant to take away that this deck is a steaming pile of something or other, but it was also doing pretty well in the modern prelims during the week and has popped up here and there offline too. So I think this deck has some amount of staying power, but I think that it is a little hard to wrap your head around at first. And if you have a lot of experience playing these Fair Thoughtseize decks, I would not assume necessarily that a lot of that experience and those heuristics are going to translate cleanly over to this, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I it's mostly like with Thoughtseize, you're like trying to line up a bunch of answers and like take a single card. It's a little even when you get like to take cards, it's usually like, oh, I'm taking a card off grief and then another card off grief, and like that just plays out really differently.
Yeah. So with that, I think we can move on to the main segment here. Making great time here, a pretty short result segment this week. We can use some of that time to get through the housekeeping announcements. So as always, you can find the podcast on Twitter at @dominari_pod. Get announcements of new episodes there or in the Discord, which as always is a growing, flourishing community. Always happy to see new arrivals in there as well. And then you can find the podcast and support it potentially on Patreon at patreon.com/dominarius_judgment. So with that, let's get into the main meat of the episode here, which is, I guess, three different formats and then also a general look at team events as a whole. So where do you think is best to start there?
We can start at the top with the usual team tournament spiel, which is, at least my side, is that, you know, you can expect more of the best decks in the format, because if you sit down and then try to convince two of your friends that you should be playing Calibrated Blast, they may find a new third friend. So you're more likely to just sit down with, you know, is it Murktide or something, so that you still have a team for the tournament. I mean, not literally, but like, there is a social pressure aspect of just like playing a good deck as opposed to taking a risk in a lot of these formats. So I would expect just to play against more of all those best decks. But not in any sort of like filtered quantity. So like maybe like this is a slightly worse week for Hammer or something. I don't think that matters a ton, because every time your Modern player has a win or loss, there's just a chance that the other two matches go the wrong way and that player's like record is not what the overall team record is in the tournament. So that sort of anti-correlation means that it takes a little longer for the like best metagame choices to filter to the top. The metagame's just a little more noisy, and it looks a lot more like when you open up Goldfish and they have all the percentages and you're just like, ah, yes, those are percentages. That's about what it looks like. Just cut some of the percentage off all the like random gruel decks towards the bottom of that share and put it on the decks at the top, and you are about right for what you could expect and probably should play one of those decks unless you are like, I don't know. I think there's a lot of Modern decks that fall into that like tier one, tier two category where they're totally fine to play. But like, if you are going completely outside that category, you should really think about like, what are my matchups against all the best decks? Because I will be playing against a very solid spread of those.
The one format I never quite know how to unpack for these split format team events is Legacy, where on the one hand, this is the least accessible of the formats in, you know, monetary terms in many ways, and requires the most, I think, institutional knowledge if you really want to master it. At the same time, so you would think that first thing would point towards there would be a lot of players who they want to team with their friends, and they have someone in the squad who has been playing some Pioneer, has been playing some Modern, but we got to fill the Legacy seat somehow, and we're going to, I guess, either see if we can find a Legacy deck from somewhere, or if we need to build one, then that would maybe point towards the decks with a lower barrier to entry. So in Modern Legacy, that would be something like 8 cards potentially, Death and Taxes, or some of the like the combo decks, which are kind of easier to play if you want something that just has a lot of raw power, even if you're not going to be piloting that deck at anywhere near full capacity. So something like Reanimator would be a classic example there, or Oops All Spells, which actually has been doing pretty well in recent online results. On the other hand, I think for a tournament that is in specifically Baltimore, like the Northeast United States is full of absolute sharks when it comes to Legacy, and my experience is that it's almost the opposite. It's that this is one of the few occasions where the Legacy players get to come out and play and get to participate in this kind of higher stakes team event, and so the team almost gets built around the Legacy player. It's, we know who's going to be playing Legacy, and they'll be playing this archetype that they are a complete master of, and we'll let them do their thing, and then they'll just find someone to play Pioneer, someone to play Modern, and that will take care of itself.
Yeah, the North, it's kind of weird up here, especially because like there's also a weird concentration of Tabernacle players, and you can expect there's this whole idea that, like, you know, for years, not a lot of people played lands because only Maniacs played lands, but then all the Maniacs lived in the state of Maryland. So whenever you showed up to a tournament over in this region, you would just play against lands like three times as much as you would at any other event. It's been a while. I don't know how much that holds. We'll talk a bit more about how much lands holds up in the current Legacy metagame. But I think that you need to be slightly more prepared for the gacha decks. even if I do think some of those, like, especially Reanimator, there's a lot of room for good play. And you probably need to be a... I guess the more accurate statement is we should talk more about what defines that, like, legacy top tier, because it's going to be even more concentrated towards that than any of the other formats. And it might almost be to the point where there's exploits available.
Yeah, let's table that for the time being then. I think we might want to cross Modern off the list first, because this is the format that we come in here to talk about basically every week. But as a result, I think that's the format where we have the least new things to say after last week, where we just, you know, said everything that had happened recently there.
Yeah, I mean, my opinion is that I am still losing with basically everything. I have finally notched my first winning Modern League in multiple weeks with a 3-2 with Cascade Elementals. It has not been good. I would just... I don't know. I'm just going to say show up with Izzet or Creativity. I like Creativity a lot, but like that might not be your jam, and it's really hard to go wrong with Izzet. I have yet to be convinced that four color is the deck that I want to be playing, but like, I don't know, you do you on that front. I'll let you make an argument for four color Traverse if you would like, but if you have decks other than Amulet you would recommend to people, what would they be?
I don't know if I would even recommend Amulet to people, honestly, but the four color Traverse deck, I think it is strong. I think that I've seen a lot of the pilots of that deck say that they're working harder for their wins now than they were even a few weeks ago, so some amount of adaptation is happening, and you do need to bring your A game and play smart and play focused, but also play fast as well, and that is easier said than done, especially at a team event. And this is the one kind of format specific caveat in a way, for like as in tournament format rather than just Magic format, in the sense of with a team event it is very easy to deliberate over a line the way that you would normally, and then get one of your teammates involved, and then you go back and forth, and then maybe the third person gets involved, and before you know it you are eating up a lot of the clock in a way that maybe is not readily apparent to you on a decision which frankly the three of you are not making any more progress on than the one person who was assigned to play that deck would have by themselves. And so especially in a format where the default expectation for a four color mirror is there is a strong risk here of us going to time, especially if we have to play three games, and there needs to be this understanding from the outset that we will shortcut as much as possible, communicate clearly, but also understand what we're here for. That is even more of an acute factor in a team event. And so, you know, if I'm sitting down in the modern seat against my opponent and they reveal Yorion and I reveal Yorion, like that conversation needs to happen, and you both need to hold up your end of the bargain there.
Yeah, I think this might also even be a spot where it is actively unfortunate that the modern seat is the center seat, because that is the player most likely to be pestered with questions or asked questions, which is only going to add to this problem.
Yeah, I personally enjoyed back in the day when the go-to team format was like unified constructed, and you had these incredibly arcane debates over, well, we're going to put this player in the B seat because... they're going to have a faster deck, which means that they're going to finish their matches quicker and be more ready to help the AC or the CC. So then if everyone else is doing that, then we want the deck that we put in the BC to be better against those faster decks. And you would just like get in this weird leveling war over something which in practice did not really matter one iota, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that is about right, because then you just have like teams where it's just like, you know, this person just wants to do their thing. Do you want them on your left or right? And you're just like, ah, yes, I want them on my right, because then my life pad is in their space and I don't have to worry about it. And that was the decision that, you know, decided where people put their decks. You know, it's just complete nonsense.
Or even some of these like Team Modern opens in the past where I remember like sitting in the C seat for one of those events and just running into this wall of bad matchups, or like the one bad matchup for my deck, you know, playing KCI, just every other round just getting crushed into small pieces by Banned Spirits. And it's like, well, if I'd been in the A seat this wouldn't be happening to me, but also even thinking about it in those terms is a losing battle. Like there is nothing productive that can possibly come out of that conversation, because it is at that point entirely arbitrary, and there's no possible logic you can use to trick yourself into thinking that there's any, you know, anything going on here.
Yeah, I'm actually also reminded of the opposite of that, where this was Grand Prix Detroit. It may have been the same event because KCI was legal, but it was me, Jarvis, and our friend Alex. And Alex described his route in the C seat as like being in the sidecar on like one of those old timey cars and just like having the pretend steering wheel. Because I believe like the first five rounds, his result didn't matter. And he just kept playing like an increasingly more absurd series of matchups while playing Hollow One. And it was just like, yeah, we're just randomly discarding cards in like tier two versus tier five deck. And like you're over there playing like humans versus KCI and like Tron mirrors. And I'm just over here like, wee. So yeah, the, you know, team tournaments always generate experiences.
This is why a good team tournament is like the pinnacle of paper magic. There's really nothing that can compare. Going back to modern recommendations, I guess, I think if you are proficient with any of the Cascade decks in particular, I think that is a fine choice. I would be tempted to pull the trigger on the Glimpse deck, I think, especially given its wave of recent results. The one thing I'm not quite sure about is Hammer, because we've seen it have this resurgence online in the past few weeks, but I don't know if there's any contextual stuff online that would stop that from translating cleanly back to paper in any way.
I don't think so. I do want to counter your recommendation of the Glimpse deck. My experience has basically been that that deck was really good for the weeks where 4-color was on its way down, and now that 4-color is back on its way up, you have to play against a deck that is good at controlling your mediocre elemental stuff while also playing Teferi, and it's just bad.
I think especially now that a lot of those 4-color decks also have Chalice on the sideboard too, where you're kind of lining up your Cascade spells against their Teferis and Chalices, and that's not a winning battle for you. But then also, if you're trying to fight this fair backup plan, which is the reason to embrace this deck and this build of the deck over the alternatives, well then, often, you are effectively playing this Risen Reef Omnath Mirror, where they have all the same cards as you, but more consistent access to them and better removal for your copies of them. And it's like, well, I'm not sure which of these fights we're hoping to win exactly.
Yeah, that deck is at its best when, like, your opponent is trying to Flusterstorm, but also their deck is really bad at handling, like, any two or three random elementals being flipped onto the table. Like, it was really potent against Grixis Shadow, not so much against this spread.
Yeah, so I guess we don't really have too much interesting to say here. We kind of know what the good decks are at this point. Play one of the good decks. Really can't go wrong with like Murktide or 4-color. Creativity, I think, has proven itself enough in recent weeks that you can wholeheartedly endorse that as well. And then, you know, kind of take your pick elsewhere. Let's go on to Pioneer, where I feel there's something of a loss here, because even though I am in the Pioneer seat for this event and have been trying to put the due diligence in and test a few different decks and consuming a lot of Pioneer content and so on, I think I am less confident in this format than I am in any of the others at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Pioneer is just I don't want to say lower agency format, but that's like the best words that are coming to mind now. Modern and Legacy are in part defined by your access to free spells. Pioneer is defined by your access to 2-mana pieces of interaction. And just, like, there's a lot more ways for games to go in such a way that there is no way to cast your answers in a tempo-positive way, even if they line up and just, like, you lose the game and started the game behind and ended the game dead. I don't know. Like, there are a lot of things you can do to mitigate that, but I think the hallmark of this is, like, the Rakdos deck existing and then, like, having to change its 2-mana removal spells every single week just so that it draws the correct ones. And that's just kind of like the peak of the Pioneer experience.
Yeah, you can still run into the top of the range for basically any of the more linear decks, but you feel like there's less you could have done about it. So yeah, in Modern, there's a lot of ways that you can just die in absurd fashion out of nowhere in the first few turns, but there are also a lot of cards you could put in your deck to mitigate those, or you know, you can always do that post-game procedure of, like, look at all of these, this amazing counterplay I could have drawn, but just, you know, didn't have access to in this game. With Pioneer, it sometimes feels like, yeah, you get walloped by a gigantic Illuminator Virtuoso, or your mono-green opponent has turn 3 Storm the Festival into good hits off of that, and it's like, well, I'm not quite sure exactly what you want me to do about that. That's just part of what I signed up for.
Yeah, so where should we start with the various Pioneer options? Like, I guess maybe Green Devotion is a good place to start, because that deck has had a pretty big comeback on the back of some stuff. It's really just the, like, make up a man meme, and they just, like, put an arbitrary Planeswalker in there and then come up with some convoluted, like, 15-step justification for why, you know, Teferi, who something's the sunset, literally just making these cards up as they go. And it's like, yes, this card allows me to combo from, like, 4 Devotion and a Mana Elf.
Yeah, I think Green Devotion is a great place to start, because it points to this broader trend that I think is worth discussing here of the shape of the format is essentially the same as it was the last time we did this this wider check-in on Pioneer. But each of those decks has some weird churn going on beneath the surface there. So with Green Devotion, we are really stretching the mono-green part of that label to its breaking point. And with Oath of Nyssa effectively erasing colored mana symbols from Planeswalkers, and if you're casting Storm the Festival into something, you don't really care what those pips are doing in the top right corner, people are justifying putting some weird and wacky Planeswalkers in their deck. So the first step of this iteration was Bobby Fortunelli, I think, is the culprit here, finding Nicol Bolas Dragon Guard, which has been completely unplayable in any, like, Grixis deck hoping to actually cast that card with its appropriate colored mana symbols and use it fairly. But in these weird, like, Oath of Nyssa Interplanar Beacon piles, sometimes it just fills this very specific niche. And so in here, what it does is, firstly, it just juices up your Storm the Festivals, and that card really wants you to have these high impact 4-drops and 5-drops a hit, and it certainly fits the bill there. But also, if you have this in play when you're trying to piece together the various disparate parts of your combo, then it can be, because it steals the abilities of all other Planeswalkers, it can be another set of Karn activations, or it can be a Kiora, which is untapping your Nykthos to generate even more mana and then let you start cycling through those loops with even less devotion. And so you have to really follow the flowchart to some pretty weird places to understand all the lines it actually enables, but rest assured, just take my word for it, that it streamlines a lot of that.
Well, you missed the most important one, which is that when you infinite combo, it allows your Nykthos to tap for black mana so that you can Pestilent Cauldron your opponent. Like, previously, there was this whole, like, Overgrown Tomb setup, and there's now, like, some crazy convoluted setup involving, like, putting your deck into your hand. Also, like, it eventually pluses through the infinite combo to ultimate. Listen, someone's going to have to show you the flowchart, like Dom said, but it's certainly there, and it is, in fact, an endgame to the infinite combo.
Well, you see, back in the day, the go-to was, well, I'll just have one Overgrown Tomb in my deck, and so when I grab my Golos from my Karn wishboard, well, that can find the Overgrown Tomb, and I can untap that with Kiora, and that's going to get me the black mana eventually. And that felt like a little convoluted, but whatever, that's fine. And then there was this whole debate over what is the least embarrassing and undignifying source of black mana we can put in our 75 somewhere? So do we actually want a Golgari Locket? Do we want a Chromatic Lantern? Do we want a Jack-O-Lantern? Do we, there was a lot of scryfall searches to find very strange cards, which this is the first time in history they've been used for this purpose, and it's not clear that they're even any good at it. But then the Nicol Bolas set up this backdoor way of doing that, where as long as you could draw your deck, you would eventually be able to put Nicol Bolas into play, and then your Nykthos would tap for black, and that would circumvent the need for any of these ugly Overgrown Tombs or what have you. And so I think at first it was like, well, we'll have Maze Mind Tomb in our sideboard and that will draw our deck. But then people realize that if you turn the Maze Mind Tomb into a Reckoner Bankbuster, well, eventually, once you keep tapping and untapping that, the final chapter, I suppose, puts a treasure token into play, and that gets you that all-important black mana, so you don't even need to go through all of those steps in the first place. So that was just a whole strange conversation to bear witness to. And then the other 5-mana Planeswalker that kind of crept its way back in was not Nyssa Who Shakes the World, which was the cornerstone of Mono Green Devotion in its first iteration, and, you know, format-defining card across Standard, Historic, Pioneer for a long time. It was actually Nyssa Vital Force, this other 5-mana Nyssa from Kaladesh, where the +1 is just untapped target land, and it becomes a 5-5, and then the -3 you can return a permanent from your graveyard to your hand. So the land you're untapping is going to be Nykthos, as always, or maybe a land that has a Wolf Willow Haven or an Old Growth Troll on it. But then the ability to regrow Planeswalkers means that you're kind of aping that Pestilent Cauldron loop in a different way with a Planeswalker. And so that leads to some other very specific lines when you have your Chain Veil going and you're looping your cards and Kioras. And again, if I knew the specifics, I would tell you. I don't, but I'm reliably assured that this happens and this makes it all easier to happen.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention my new favorite black source from the deck that was, I believe, discovered by Bobby today, which is Secret Door. And the joke is that you always have blue mana off of Nykthos because of Kiora, so you will be able to infinitely venture into dungeons and make black mana that way.
Hell yeah. I'm not going to ask how many clicks this take on Magic Online, but I feel like once you commit to going through the Secret Door loop, you deserve however many clicks that forces upon you. It reminds me of how your evil twin, Ari Zax, was getting progressively more absurd in finding the right kill for the Neoform loops. And it's like, well, past a certain point, it can be literally whatever you want it to be. And so you can get creative there in a spot where, you know, every important decision you've already made, and now it's just finding ways to enjoy yourself on the side.
Yeah, that sounds like a very accurate description of what the mono green hive mind is going through. Thumbs up, thumbs down on mono green. I mean, I guess I'll broadly say this about Pioneer. I think a lot of decks that are just like vaguely existing, I can give a thumbs up to, because I think that there's just room. Like, it's the reverse of Modern, where like there are 8 decks that are very good, and if you pilot them well, they're like going to do it. I think in Pioneer, there's like 5 to 6 decks that are like good enough, and like the margins of just like, if you did your thing, you'll win the match, are close enough that you could play any of them.
Yeah, so mono green is a deck that I have the most experience with, I think, at this point, and I still don't quite know how to feel about it. It feels incredibly volatile in the sense that when it's doing its thing, it really feels like you're playing a totally different format and doing something that should not still be legal in this format. And then the rest of the time, when, you know, your elf dies and your hand isn't functional anymore, or you're just on the draw against the wrong kind of interaction, and either way, it feels like there's very little agency involved. And then the mono green mirror in particular is absolutely miserable. And in 90% of games, it's going to be just whoever has the best draw. And there's really no kind of agency or counterplay. It's just both of you vomit your hands on the table, and usually the player who is on the play and has the pieces they need gets to do that. And then the other 10% of games get into these very weird, obscure holding patterns where the ground is clogged up. Like, both players have a bunch of like Old Growth Trolls and Cavalier of Thorns that are threatening to bounce off each other, but neither one of them is actually making progress to overwhelm the opponent. And so you get into these weird fights of like preemptively conning for ways to shut down the opponent's con, because even though your con is now shut off too, it means that they can't leverage their onboard stuff in any relevant way, or it becomes very weirdly tactical in a way that you kind of have to be good at figuring out on the fly. And those games are really fascinating, and they're fascinating to watch and take part in. And but I don't know if the vast majority of games, which feel like you've wasted your entire day by signing up for this, are worth chasing that high for. So I don't know. It's the answer to this one. And we didn't even touch on the later stages of the developments in this deck in recent weeks. So stage 2, I guess, was realizing that, well, okay, if the idea of introducing black mana to this deck has entered the equation, well, why not actually embrace that and add some black cards and some more black sources to the deck? And so in those main deck flex slots that the Nicol Boluses and the tier 2 Nissas of the world were taking up before, we now have Vraska Golgari Queen. So this is the Guilds of Ravnica 4-mana Vraska, where the +1 lets you sacrifice a permanent, and if you do, you gain a life, you draw a card. The -3 can abrupt decay something, essentially. And then there's an ultimate that rounds to you win the game, as is often the case. So what this does, it kind of does a few things. The first is that this is just a good Planeswalker 2 cast in your deck. You know, you can very easily cast this one on turn 3. You can shoot the thing in the ice out of Phoenix, or the Illuminator Virtuoso, excuse me, out of Heroic that would otherwise threaten to race you. And then the +1 ensures you have this steady stream of gas, where you often have, let's say, a redundant Oathiness that you're happy to toss away to find a new card. There will be spots where you are keen to sacrifice your Allgrowth Troll, which, like, you kind of send into combat hoping that it trades off and dies to something, and your opponent knows that and they never give you that opportunity. Or often you find yourself with Cavalier of Thorns, where you would really like to be able to sacrifice that for some kind of benefit to get that regrowth ability and draw something else, but you can't engineer a spot where that's going to happen. Vraska lets you do that as well. So the plus one actually is surprisingly important and versatile in the deck, but also this opens up some its own subset of combo lines, where once you have Ugin's Nexus in your sideboard, this is a fan favorite from Fate Reforged, where your opponent can't take extra turns, and when Ugin's Nexus dies, you can exile it, and if you do, you take another turn. So the gimmick here is, firstly, against Phoenix, sometimes the static text just shutting off Temporal Trespass will come up a lot, but the actual combo line is you plus one Vraska, you sacrifice the Nexus, you take another turn. That Nexus has exiled itself in the process, which means that Khan can grab it with its minus two from exile, and so you effectively get as many extra turns, and so as many extra draw steps or attacks or planeswalker aggravations as that will amount to for every two loyalty you have on your Khan. And so if you have a backup Khan, or if you have a way to find or regrow a new Khan, you can just keep that going over and over again and not have to actually unlock any kind of weirdly elaborate deterministic kill.
Anyways, mono green, you make some game actions and then you go infinite is really what happens. The deck is more than the infinite combo for sure. But this falls under the absurd new developments of like, how do we go infinite the infinitiest? It's like a really short infinite with Ugin's Nexus, where you just like minus Karn twice, and like if you take multiple extra turns in a row, and like, I don't know, it's just really hard to lose after you effectively cast Time Stretch. But yeah, I am unconvinced that most of this is better than the actual like mono green shell, or whether it's worth putting Overgrown Tomb in your deck and paying a bunch of life. But it is certainly on the table, and if your opponent starts playing black mana in their mono green deck, that is what you should expect.
Yeah, the other half of that now is Fatal Push in the sideboard, which is actually a pretty relevant effect to have access to in the matchups where speed is of the essence. So most of the rest of Pioneer at this point is these quite fast, small creature decks, and so being able to actually break serve for one mana is a pretty big deal, especially when a lot of those decks are relying on specific cards or specific lines to enable them to do that. So as they keep coming back to, you know, Heroic, there's a big difference between their draws that have Illuminator Virtuoso and their draws that don't, or their play pattern inherent to the deck is, I'm going to load up on one creature and then use a God's Willing to get that thing across the finish line, or an Invigorated Rampage, something like that. And so having a timely Fatal Push can really swing all of that back in your favor. We didn't even mention, by the way, the step 2B here, which is color shifting now from black to white for Teferi Who Slows the Sunset, which that one untaps an artifact, a creature, and a land all at the same time with its plus ability, and so that makes these combo lines almost effortless, where you're generating so much mana off pretty low resources that you can cut out the middleman if you like, just jump straight to the end of that that execution branch. But I think that the Black Splash, like, I think Vraska is just a good card to have access to, and I think Fatal Push appeals to me as well. So I think the kind of what would used to be termed like big G / small B devotion, I think, is the approach that I might look into here if I was locked into playing this archetype.
Yeah, I would stick to mono green, I think. I think I just want the most consistent, least self-damaging shell. And I think we can get into some of that in a second with the next monocolor deck on our list, because I think that your life total has started to matter a little bit more in the metagame.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and you're making this trade-off between making your mana worse and opening yourself up to both mana problems and a more painful mana base in return for cards which, in theory, help you against those faster starts from the aggressive deck. So it's unclear exactly how that all comes out in the wash, but one of those aggressive decks that we're seeing more and more here is mono red, and this is not necessarily the type of mono red deck that you would expect to play against a few months ago, where it's essentially a prowess deck headlined by the one drops in Monastery Swift Spear and Soulscar Mage, and backed up by a ton of cheap burn spells and light up the stage to keep the cards flowing, and stuff like Chandra Dress to Kill in the 3-drop slot. And this was very much a spell focused take on that archetype. What we're seeing now is a version of mono red that really plays to the board, and it's quite reminiscent of the mono red decks from like Kaldheim Standard, where you had the same top end in Anax plus Embercleave as this almost like Splinter Twin S kill, and then Torbran as your other 4-drop finisher, and then a bunch of smaller creatures lower down the curve, and only a tiny smattering of like actual burn spells that don't affect the board in any way otherwise.
Yeah, and I think some of this is a reaction to like the large rise in both Izzet and Rakdos, two decks that are fairly good at, like, if your deck is like the traditional or almost the traditional like 20-20-20 land spells creatures, they're very good at killing the 20 creatures and then not dying to the 20 spells. So you need to be all creatures or like really efficient burn. I'm thinking like something close to like the Theros era standard burn decks, and the Pioneer metagame is not really set up for that deck to exist. So it's really just got to go down the Embercleave era creature line to get anywhere with a true mono red deck.
Yeah, I fiddled around with various builds of mono red yesterday, and the one thing I took away was that Goblin Train Whirler is kind of messed up at the moment, where one of the trends we're seeing in the format, and mono red is part of this equation itself, is this move towards the small creature deck. So you have Green Devotion, where, again, having that turn one elf in your draw and then survive is a big part of that deck's success. But then also you have, you know, mono white humans, Bant humans, the mono blue spirits deck. You have all of these various creature decks floating around, and Goblin Train Whirler often is the best flame time carver you could hope for against those decks. And then even in matchups where, you know, there are no X ones for you to pick off for free, then a 3-3 with First Strike is a very relevant stat line. So against Rakdos, for example, you know, this is a card which can attack effectively into Bonecrusher Giant or into Graveyard Trespasser, or even just the threat of having that card in your deck frees up your other creatures to make some more daring attacks, because your opponent making the obvious block to soak up damage and then losing their creature to a Train Whirler is a pretty big blowout. So, you know, the card Sylvan Caryatid, for example, has been a pretty big issue for mono red decks in the past, but if you can attack your two power creature into their Caryatid and really put them to the test over whether they can afford to block or not, well, you're going to get a few free points in that way, and if you do actually get to put that blowout together, then you're off to the races there as well. So there's a lot of competition in these decks for that 3-drop spot, but I would, you know, I would lock in my Bonecrusher Giants, and then I would lock in my Goblin Train Whirlers before anything else. I think that's a big part of the deck strength right now, and I think that's also why you can justify playing this approach, where some of the appeal of the prowess one drops is there just aren't that many one drops to choose between, right? You don't have Goblin Guides in this format. You don't have there's no like Figure of Destiny. There's no really good consistent one drop that you know that you want, and so if you don't have enough spells to support those, what are you meant to turn to instead? And the fact that Fanatical Firebrand actually can be a removal spell a decent amount of the time in a format full of X1s, I think is part of why this build is able to succeed. If Firebrand was just a mopey Mug Fanatic, I don't think this deck would have what it takes.
Yeah, I mean, Kumano Faces Kakadon is pretty nice, but I agree that the one drops past that have some issues along the way.
Oh yeah, Kumano Faces Kakadon is messed up, and it's actually, I think, the best one drop in the prowess focused versions too, not least because it is a one drop that triggers prowess, right? Like if you lead on a Swift Spear or a Soulscar Mage, you get to play Kumano on turn two, trigger prowess, and then set up to get your plus one counter on your 3-drop the following turn. So yeah, that card is phenomenal and is the building block for any red deck in this format at this point. The only question is, what's the other stuff that you surround it with?
Yeah, you know, I think that the red decks have, like, their first 12 or so cards are really good, and they're just struggling to fill in the rest with whatever sounds good at the moment. Still not the hugest fan of the red decks. I have not found them to be, even these latest lists, not phenomenal against Rakdos, which still looks to be the most popular deck. But they're trending in the right direction to actually try to beat that deck.
Yeah, and the other thing that really appeals to me about this deck, and it's part of this trend that we see with the other monocolor aggro decks is having this really nice, clean mana base. We speak a lot about how there's this big discrepancy between the enemy mana and the allied mana in Pioneer, and there are just inherent difficulties with playing some of these two-color decks. Being in one color and getting, like, clean, consistent mana as well as the on-color manland of your choice, you know, getting to play four Den of the Bugbear, a Soken Zan, some Ramen Apparins, or some Castle Embreths, which is another really good kind of mid-game card in this deck, and then just a pile of basic mountains, that is the best mana you could really ask for in this format, I think.
Yeah, can you try to talk me into Castle Embreth? Because I see these decks that are, like, trying to play, like, 11 mountains with Castle Embreth and all these bone drops, and that just feels like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I don't think you can do that exactly. I think once you get more into, like, the 23, 24 land range, and then your mana base can support maybe 2 to 3 castles, I think that's where you want to be. But I found that it just, like, the way the creature sizing lines up in the format, you get into spots where, you know, your Chain Whirler attacking with 4 power instead of 3 means that, you know, Old Growth Troll is no longer a good blocker, or, you know, you have your carries there ready to go, and now Castle Embreth is +2 damage at, just by virtue of that alone, and then anything else can contribute to that, or you had an Anax maybe, and so you have a bunch of these 1-1 Sailors lying around, which by themselves are not really relevant game objects, but once you introduce Castle into the mix, and they're attacking for 2 instead of 1, well, now that adds up to something meaningful. So, once you get to the point where Castle is low cost, if not exactly free, then I think the first copy or two does go a long way.
That's fair. I think that, you know, I'm looking at lists right now, and, like, I feel like, I don't know, it's, like, very excessive to have Ramen Apparins and Sokenzin in your deck with multiple Castle Embreths, and that felt sketchy to me, but maybe you can kind of hit just the right number of mountains that you don't draw these hands that it doesn't line up with, or maybe you can build your curve where, like, I guess, like, these other lists that just have, like, Eidolon in the 2-drop slot can maybe afford to, you know, well, your 1-drop is a 1-drop, and then your 2-drop is, like, another 1-drop in the Castle Ember, so maybe that's a little better.
Yeah, what I found was that once my deck was full of, you know, Eidolons and Goblin Chain Whirlers, and I was actually having to take pain off Ramen Apparins a decent amount of the time, and then I didn't really have the burn as reach to get across the finish line, so the 2 damage from Ruins was less important because either I'm attacking for big chunks and the 2 damage doesn't mean much, and then there's less of, like, well, this Lightning Strike and this Play with Fire and this Ramen Apparins are going to add up to exactly enough. Without all of that in the mix, I found that Ruins just wasn't doing as much for me, and that's where I found room to have some more castles but also have enough mountains to not get these, like, Den of the Bugbear castle draws, which would just screw me over.
That makes sense. So something along the lines of, like, a pile of mountains, 4 dens, 2 castles, and, like, maybe the second Sokenzin as well?
I'm not so sure about the second Sokenzin. Like, drawing 2 can be kind of a disaster, but something along those lines, for sure. I guess my parting thought on this deck is, other specifics aside, Embercleave is exactly as scary as you remember it being from Standard, and we've highlighted this hole in Pioneer in the past of just, like, there's not that much good instant speed removal, and so this was something that the Winota decks famously were really trying hard to exploit, and Embercleave can drive a wedge right through that as well. And this deck is quite good at assembling a fast Embercleave draw, so if you have, you know, a 1-drop into Karizav on turn 2, that's a turn 3 Embercleave if you have a third land, because between Ragavan off Karizav itself and the 1-drop and your 3 mana, like, that pays for your Embercleave. And then, usually the Embercleave in that spot is not doing a ton, because putting it on Karizev doesn't do much, and your 1-drops are a little bit mopey, but just, you can get these really fast, consistent cleaves, even through the face of removal. And then, if you get to put it on anything larger, often that is the one thing that can bail you out of a ball position which has become kind of clogged up, and you can see the writing on the wall, and you're hoping, you know, the one thing that can get me out of this is drawing Embercleave, and, like, being able to play towards that is really nice.
I'm sorry, you just said Ragavan and it broke my brain about what format we were talking about. I forgot that was originally the token up Karizav, but yeah.
No. I would love to put an Embercleave on that Ragavan. That sounds like a good time.
Yeah, how do you feel about Burning Tree Emissary, by the way? That seems like a card I would try to not play in these decks, but I don't know if it's extremely important with the cleave.
I tried the list, the stock list with Emissary, and kind of hated it. It does contribute to some of your faster draws, but it is often the first card that you reach for in sideboarding, which by itself does not mean that a card doesn't belong in your main deck, but it does suggest that it fills a specific role, and I found that I just wasn't needing that specific role as often as it seemed like I should be. And it was often, you know, the same way that past a certain point, Ember Cleave is the best card in your deck. After, you know, turn two, Burning Tree Emissary is basically always the worst draw in your deck. So I took any excuse to get those out of there and was happy doing that. And at a certain point, I just cut them all together and didn't miss them.
That checks out. What about the rest of the aggro decks in the format? Like, you had highlighted this absolutely awesome, I guess, successor to the Ensoul deck that popped up recently. But there's also, like, a variety of humans decks. I know Max McFeedy's been pushing, like, Bant humans. There's the mono-white deck that is just playing a billion Hopeful Initiates. Where have you gotten with any of those?
Yeah, we saw WotC underscore Michael Majors in the decklist dump this week with Black-White Auras as well. So it reminds me of this shift that the format went through at the start of the year, where there were a ton of these aggro decks seemingly powered by Lurrus. So you had Ensoul, you had Auras, you had Heroic, you had all of these various different decks, and then the loss of Lurrus was a death knell to some of them, or so it seemed at the time, but now we're seeing basically all of those popping up once again, in some cases because the loss of Lurrus wasn't the death knell that it seemed, but also because they've had this shot in the arm from new cards. So you have Illuminated Virtuoso in Heroic, you've got a bunch of these new additions for the Ensoul style decks, even though some of them aren't even in blue for Ensoul anymore. So there's a lot of stuff going on in that space. And if you go to, you know, the MTG Goldfish page, which I would generally caution people against using that as an actual metagame breakdown, because the methodology there is kind of opaque and kind of suspect. But if you just want a sense of what people are doing in the format, a lot of it is just these, like, low to the ground, one color, two color aggro decks, whether it's just straight mono red aggro, or there's some kind of, like, tribal sub theme or card type sub theme, what have you. That is a lot of what you can expect to face in any given Pioneer tournament, and that is most of the, like, flora and fauna of the format at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Mono Blue Spirits has been on a bit of a downswing. Do you have a good reason for that? But, like, that was the deck I would always think of when you're talking about, like, these monocolor decks, and that seems to be the one that might honestly be doing the worst over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I think the consensus there is the Rakdos matchup is pretty tough, and then beyond that, it's meant to exploit the decks that are trying to go larger, so it's meant to prey on stuff like Green Devotion, Blue Eye Control, and then just the random stuff that's trying to outscale the Rakdos decks, and it's really hoping to not play against the other low-to-the-ground aggro decks, and there are just so many more of those around at this stage.
Yeah, that's fair. Those matchups are, even if you are playing out of your mind, close or tough, like, not great. And that's if you are literally, like, playing flawlessly every turn, like plotting out these games where your opponent is at negative one life and you're at one life. It's just like a lot of work to get anywhere close to even.
Yeah, I could see a move back towards stuff like Blue Eye Spirits or Bant Spirits, which in my experience are actually pretty solid in these creature head-to-heads, but I don't know if you're giving up too much elsewhere on the margins that you need to account for there.
Yeah, I don't even know if that sounds that much better than like Bant Humans, because a lot of the stuff in Bant Humans is going to be really crushing in these mirrors. Like, Extraction Specialist and Reflector Mage are just great cards in any of these aggro mirrors. So that might be a better immediate direction to turn. Especially, like,
that was... Yeah. Yeah, that was Max McVitie's verdict as well. Someone who has been doing most of the work to put Bant Humans on the map. His take essentially was that if you get to the point where you're tempted to play Bant Spirits, just play Bant Humans, because it's kind of doing the same thing in a more reliable and consistent way.
Yeah, Specialist is a really, really good card. That was my takeaway from my, like, experiments a while back with the Pyre Humans deck, was basically just, like, I was winning games more by just, like, casting Specialist and making a billion power because my 3-drop was, like, a 3-2 lifelink that also brought back a Thalia's Lieutenant or a Charming Prince and then, like, got something else back.
Yeah, it is really demoralizing to be on the wrong end of those Specialist loops, especially if you're figuring out exactly how those work for the first time. So there's a lot of, like, because Champion Prince exiles something and then brings it back at the beginning of the next end step, there's a lot of weird looping between ends of different turn cycles where, like, this thing is coming back at this time and so on, and you need to have a sense of how that timing is going to work in order to play against that effectively.
Yeah, it also is, like, the kind of thing where, like, you play these games where, like, you go through all this work to solve this problem, and then just, like, oh, yeah, they just put, like, they have so many cards that put so many bodies into play at once. Like, not just specialists, but, like, collected company for all these cards in some of the lists. Like, it is overall tough to be attempting to one-for-one with this deck.
Yeah, and this deck, like, the individual threats are quite powerful as well. You have stuff like Werewolf Pack Leader, you have Thalia, which often is, like, the scariest 2-drop in the entire format for some decks. You have a lot of individual card power. The one thing that really holds me back on this deck is the mana base, where, like, you look at these, all of these different pathways, where if you have to put one of these on white, then your Werewolf Pack Leader suddenly looks hard to cast, or this Botanical Sanctum is not casting Hopeful Initiate anytime soon, and there's a lot of ways for your mana to just kind of fail you, even when your spells are, or could get the job done. And, like, as we flagged up before, actually casting Collected Company is not trivial either, even at the stage of the game, where ideally you have four lands with which to cast your Collected Company. So I think the mana, honestly, is the biggest thing holding this deck back. Also, in some matchups, like, having bigger and better threats or having more resilient threats isn't really what you're going for. So against Mono Green, for example, I think the creature sizing often lines up in a way where, okay, I have Werewolf Pack Leader, or I have, like, an Adeline or something, and it's bigger than the alternative threat in some of these other aggro decks would be in the spot, but it's still not big enough to get through a Cavalier of Thorns or an Aldgrowth Thrall. And at that point, if you are kind of developing more slowly towards these bigger threats, but those bigger threats are still not big enough, well, then you're sacrificing the speed that maybe could let you power through or go underneath those draws from the Mono Green deck in the first place.
Yeah, I'd also caution, like, this deck does have some, like you described, like, actual mana production problems. I think there's some, like, mana count problems that these decks have. There's, like, what, 23 lands in the deck, but, like, you have 14 cards that cost 3 or more, and then, like, all your 1-drops are also not very impactful. So there's just, like, a lot of ways to end up with the wrong mix of lands and spells, because it's not even, like, if you're short lands, your 1 and 2-drops are super impactful, or, like, if you're heavy on lands, the cards you're drawing are necessarily super impactful. There's just a few ways to get into the wrong mix of stuff here that are not the most fun.
Yeah, I played the historic Humans deck at the set championship, this was analogous kind of in how its cover structured, although it had even more 4-drops. That deck had, you know, 25 to 26 lands, and also some Catildas as well, functioning as additional mana sources, and even then, it felt like you were a little landlight some amount of the time, and even when you got flooded, that was fine, because you had a lot of ways to spend that excess mana, and this deck doesn't really have that either. Like, compared to something like the Mono White Humans deck, which I think is worth touching on next, I generally don't think those comparisons are useful, because I don't know, other than, okay, some of these creatures have the same type line, I think these decks are doing different things in different ways, but the appeal of, you know, the Mono Red mana base, the Mono White mana base, the Mono Blue Spirits mana base, where you get, like, clean functioning mana and also, like, a good creature land of your choice, that contrast seems so stark when you line up against, like, this secluded courtyard plus temple guard mana base that feels like it's held together with tape and glue.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the Mono White deck, because it feels like it has a lot of the same cards, but it just gets to play with better lands.
Yeah, like, Munivolt, it's easy to forget, but this is a really, really good land that was one of, if not the best card in both of the standard formats that it was legal in across time.
Yeah, I can agree with that exact statement. It has been a little worse in Pioneer than that, but, like, still very effective. It's really understated compared to the other creature lands. Like, getting to activate Den of the Bugbearer is kind of a chore. Like, Mutavault, you just kind of fire it up while you're casting other spells, and, like, I don't know, just some damage gets in there and you still have a land. It's all good stuff.
Yeah, or you compare it to, like, a Lair of the Hydra, which, yeah, if you're flooding out in the late game, then that's a perfect mana sink. But if you're just trying to get a little bit scrappy in the mid game and you're sinking 3 mana into that to make it a 2-2 versus Mutavault, where often you can cast a spell and then have a mana left over to fire up the Mutavault and start attacking, I think Mutavault is a fantastic card that was lacking a home for a while, and this is just a very good Mutavault deck.
Yeah, it. I mean, most of the other differences here aren't that big. It's kind of also interesting how, like, we talk about bad mana in the Bant deck, and this deck just, like, the white mana is so good, it's just, like, I don't know, four colorless lands in my, like, what, 12 white one-drop deck? It'll be fine. It'll all work out because it's Mutavault and it's good enough. The mana is just so much better if you just stop playing more colors.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not fine. Sometimes you have a double Mutavault plus Adeline or something, and no second bite source, and you start kicking yourself. But for the most part, this is a sacrifice that you can afford to make, and which you're very happy to make, because you're getting so much in return. The other big draw to being a monocolor deck, and specifically a mono-white aggro deck, is Brave the Elements. So this is just white for an instant, which gives your creatures protection from... protection from a color of your choice until end of turn. So this is the best, like... what's the falter effect du jour from the most recent limited set? Like the Magmatic Chasm of 2022.
Yeah, my experience with Brave the Elements in Pioneer is that it is... I feel like playing four is a little excessive. It's probably fine to load up with in game ones, but it's probably a card that you are sideboarding down to two or three in a lot of spots. Even if it does trade for removal, it's just easy to draw hands where you just have two of them. It's not what you want. Especially as your opponent gets better at interacting before Brave becomes a relevant card, and you're just like, I don't know, I'm like throwing away a Brave the Elements to protect a like random soldier of the Pantheon. I don't know. It is very powerful when it is the falter that you need, but I would caution against viewing it as like a active draw to the deck in a lot of spots. Though in the mono green matchup, it is exactly what you want.
Yeah, there's this weird dichotomy, if you like, where on the one hand, if your opponent has a ton of removal spells, then Brave is really good against like the first removal spell. But if they have a pile of those and you don't have that many threats to protect, you almost wish that Brave was something else that could force a hand on removal or was just a better threat in its own right. And it is easy to get into a spot where you're kind of Brave flooded on low resources. And even though you could protect a threat with it, well, there's no real impetus on the opponent to try and kill your threat because it isn't that threatening. It's not being backed up by anything, in part because some of your cards are these useless Braves. On the other hand, against a deck like Mono Green or some of these Creature Mirrors, actually, which are not that interactive, but where it is just a race and there's a lot of contesting the board, this is the card that lets you punch through all of their defenses and get in for that lethal attack. And so it's pretty good against the non-interactive linear decks, and then also against the removal heavy deck sometimes, and then there's this weird like space in the middle where it's unclear how it's meant to work exactly.
Yeah, Brave is just like a very weird card for how powerful it is. I guess what other decks fall under this category? I know you mentioned like Heroic as a reason to move towards Fatal Push in mono green. Do you think that like Heroic belongs in this category, or is it just kind of off doing its own weird combo thing?
I don't quite know what to make of it. I think that it rose up as a foil to Mono Green specifically, and I think is still, you know, pulling its weight in that role. There is debate over how well it lines up against the format at large. So there was this Canister versus Doommate grudge match between Heroic on Canister side and then Black Red Midrange on Doommate side, which, depending on the Black Red pilots you ask, was not entirely representative of how that matchup is meant to go. But I think that it's in this weird like aggro combo space in the format where it's distinct from some of the more pure aggro decks. But then I'm not sure what the relative merits of, let's say, Heroic are versus Mono White Humans or Mono Red or something against stuff like the control decks of the format or against some of these Creature Mirrors, where I can imagine if you get to kind of Goldfish with your Heroic deck, or if Reckless Rage is a good card, then I can see those matchups going very well. At the same time, if you're against, let's say, a mono-white humans deck, which is as efficient as you, and that's part of the draw to the humans deck, but they also have, like, Thardia, which can really mess you up, or they have a removal staple to their creatures, like Brutal Cathar, Skyclave Apparition, they have their own portable hulls. I can imagine just getting run over in those matchups as well. So, not clear to me exactly how that one plays out.
Yeah, that's also been my experience of, like, I have, like, randomly won with Heroic against mono-red, despite, like, in theory, the mono red deck should be really good against Heroic because it's, like, on the same level of picking off creatures. But also, like, sometimes if one of your creatures just lives, it runs away with the game because it just grows out of control. Or, like, you have a God's Willing for their Bone Crusher Giant and everything falls apart. it's really, I don't know. And that just keeps repeating across all these matchups, like, oh, you know, my mono white opponent, like, goes wide and, like, can chump block this, but also just, like, has absolutely no recourse against me casting Invigorated Rampage on a Illuminator Virtuoso. And I think that might be very characteristic of the Heroic deck as a whole, where, like, Monastery Swiss Spear and Illuminator Virtuoso are just, like, not playing the same game, and the cards you want with each of them are weirdly different. I mean, like, Homestead Courage sort of tries to bridge the gap, but even then it's like, I don't know, when you Homestead Courage with a Swiss Spear, it's a little bit of extra power as opposed to a lot. The whole deck is, like, sort of disjoint. I really like the deck, and it's probably my suggestion for the weekend. But at the same time, like, you have to be prepared for, like, your cards not to feel like they're playing the same game, and that to maybe be an issue if you don't try and work your way out of that bind.
Yeah, there is some tension between the heroic and pseudo-heroic mechanics like Virtuosos and the prowess stuff, and then also diminishing returns within the heroic mechanic, where it's quite easy to end up with a draw that's like favorite Hoplite, 10th District Legionnaire, and a bunch of pump spells, where you can load up on one of these two creatures, or you can try and split the difference, and it's like, well, this half of Homestead Courage is targeting this Hoplite, and then the back half is targeting the Legionnaire, and you get to medium-sized threats, but then there's often this incentive to go big on one thing and try and protect the one big thing, but then if you can't do that successfully, your backup just doesn't really get the job done because it also requires its own investment, and you just don't have the tools left over to push that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, the deck's really good, but some of your games are just going to get weird.
Yeah, also a deck which, like, I finally remember the heroic decks from back in the Standard days, or I guess similar decks like the red-green landfall deck from BFC Standard, where you had some of the same play patterns at work. I do think that picking these decks up blind, like, there's a lot of figuring out not just how to navigate through removal and tricks, but the kind of exploitative game of how to bait out a certain trick, which is effectively face up based on how the opponent's playing, which maybe does not come naturally to a lot of people. And so I would not recommend picking this deck up blind if you don't have experience with it or with decks in the same vein.
I will make a slight counter argument that I think that Pioneer is one of the easier formats to do that, because the thing I mentioned at the start, which is just like all the tricks they could have are not the most efficient and often fairly telegraphed. So it's like hard mode would be trying to, you know, Legacy Infect, where like your opponent could have a million tricks and they could be instant speed, free spells and things like that. Pioneer, it's like, I guess I'm playing around like a Shock and a Dreadboard.
Yeah, you don't have the like, I'm playing my Hammer deck versus Solitude and now every turn is a head scratcher kind of thing, because as you mentioned, the interaction in Pioneer kind of sucks, and that's why a lot of these decks are good, and that's certainly why this deck is good. And so, yeah, sometimes you just get to gun through it on easy mode and you collect your free wins that way.
Yeah. Should we talk about the deck that might be playing that Dreadbore? Because it is the, I don't know, should we call it the most popular deck on Magic Online or like the least popular deck? It's really hard to say which of those descriptions is more accurate.
I mean, it's winning basically every challenge as far as I can tell. So I think can we call this Rakdos Scam, or is it Escape the Scam label at this stage?
It might be Scam. I mean, look at the ticket price on Graveyard Trespasser and tell me that is not a scam.
I mean, that might just be the Magic Online economy, or, you know, economic systems in general are a scam, as opposed to Graveyard Trespasser or this deck are scams.
No, I actually would like to say that Graveyard Trespasser is, in fact, a scam. My opinion of that card is, like, you, as long as you don't try to kill it, it doesn't do a lot.
It does everything. It's so good.
I guess describe your limits of everything. It, like, I mean, we also did just, you know, sing the praises of Goblin Chain Whirler, so maybe Pioneer is just the format for trained Armadons, but, like, this is the trainediest of trained Armadons.
Graveyard Trespasser is everything everywhere all at once, just like every other card in this deck, right? Like Fable, Bonecrusher Giant. I guess that is maybe just a trend in modern Magic design rather than a specific compliment towards Graveyard Trespasser, but I don't know. I liked this deck conceptually before, and it's pretty hard to argue with this recent results. And if you do, Mistblade Stranger will come at you with his legions of followers. So, you know, I'm going to stay away from that. I will issue a fairly generic endorsement of this deck. Like, if you enjoy this playstyle, then, yeah, just subscribe to his Patreon, get his latest list, and you're probably good to go.
Yeah, I do think the lists have gotten a lot better. I mean, the number of Tenacious Underdogs has rapidly declined, and that, I think, is a pretty good thing. I really like the pickup of Unlicensed Hearse, like, starting to make its way into main decks. So, you kind of mentioned this whole thing about Vraska and the Mono Green deck earlier. If you actually look at how Old Growth Troll and Cavalier of Thorns are worded, I believe both of them are interrupted by an Unlicensed Hearse activation, which is pretty important when, like, Hearse is also your, like, best card against any of the Izzet decks, and, like, you have enough creatures that Hearse is just a threat that you would have. And I think that, like, one of the problems of this deck against Mono Green is not the combo kills, but just, like, what do I do when they play 3-mana 4-4 and 5-mana 5-6 that are also, like, not quite 2-for-1s, but pretty close to 2-for-1s? And if the answer is just, like, I don't know, my, like, 2-mana 10-10 just stops all that, it's a pretty good answer.
Yeah, and that's why Kalidus was the most important card by far against Mono Green before, because, like, its stats weren't that great, and, you know, the lifelink didn't matter that much, but just making your removal spells actually effective against Troll and Cavalier did so much to deflect that matchup in your favor that, you know, Hearse adding to that, while also being your best card against Phoenix and your best card in a lot of other spots, your best cards against Grieffang, which we haven't touched on yet, which we certainly will before we end this segment. I think that if you're looking for a good 2-drop to fill out the curve, well, you have this 2-drop which already was one of the best cards in your sideboard, and it's going to do a lot of good work in your main deck, and you don't need to play, you know, Tenacious Underdog to make up the numbers there.
Yeah, the other thing I like that these decks have been doing is switching over to, like, the 2-mana 4 damage removal. So I know I had seen a lot of Lava Coils, but I'm looking back now and I'm seeing a lot of Cut Ribbons as well. And that feels like it's a little more respectful to the sizing of some of the other things going on in the format, like a Ledger Shredder or a Thing in the Ice or an Old Growth Troll. Whereas, like, the previous, you know, a random Strangle or, like, whatever the other card would be that would go in that slot was not quite right. So it feels like this nice way to sort of align your removal spells a little better to the format, which I think is really important.
Yeah, so I think if you are playing Rakdos and just mindful of other trends in the format and how to fill out some of those removal, flex dots, and so on, then yeah, good choice, good deck, can expect good results for it. Let's touch on Phoenix, which gets a surprisingly little press given how much interest there is in it among a lot of the more invested players and how dominant it has been even in recent memory. And one thing I want to touch on here, there's not really new developments in this space to look at, but there seems to be this almost existential crisis among the Phoenix decks around not specifically Ledger Shredder, but it kind of speaks to a larger issue here, which is that you have 50 something cards in your Phoenix deck which you know you want and which work towards this main game plan and are good at what they do, and then it's pretty unclear how you're meant to actually fill in the rest to end up with a 60 card deck. And this is maybe just the story of Pioneer writ large, is that you have all these decks which can just about cobble together a plan for what they're doing, but have to play some sinkers in order to do that. In Phoenix's case, it's a little different, where it seemed like Ledger Shredder would be the perfect way to have this turn two threat, which can be this big thing in its own right, and which also is a much-needed discard outlet for Arclight Phoenix and so on and so forth. It feels like it ticks every box. At the same time, I think what players are noticing is that it gives you this new vulnerability to the spot removal, which otherwise your deck is very good at shrugging off, in the same way that Thing in the Ice did, and that's part of why that card was eventually cut from most of the Phoenix main decks, where, like, is your Phoenix deck good against Fatal Push? Well, for the most part, yes, it is. Except if you have a draw which is overly reliant on your turn 2 Ledger Shredder, at which point this card, which otherwise was dead against you, now becomes one of the more important cards. And that's the story kind of across the format as a whole. That's not a new dynamic, though, and I feel like many of the historically successful blue decks across all formats have had the same thing going on, where you think of, like, like exactly thing in the ice in previous standard formats, or like Jacevin's Prodigy, stuff like that, where you have this cheap threat, which, if it lives, really warps how the game plays out and massively increases your chance of winning. If it dies, then maybe you're activating removal, which would have been dead otherwise, but that's a trade-off that you can make sometimes. And then that dance of forcing the opponent to keep in removal spells that have no other function basically against your deck is often a good spot to put the opponent in. And so I don't think that backlash is going to be sustained. I think most Phoenix players are going to show up with the full set of Ledger Shredder, and they should, and they're going to be happy with it. But the fact that it's even up for debate at all highlights one of the kind of growing discontents about the deck and its place in the format.
I think I would actually almost describe it more in the context of Paulo had posted a Keep or Maul, which was a Shredder, a Thing in the Ice, 3 lands, an Arclight Phoenix, and a Temporal Trespass. And I think that my reaction was just like, if this is not a hand that I can reasonably expect to keep, like, why am I building my deck in this way that these two drops are in my deck? Like, if it's so important that I cast a generic spell to put cards in my graveyard, why is Ledger Shredder in my deck, and why is Otherworldly Gaze not in my deck?
Yeah, or the other option there is, why is Arclight Phoenix in my deck? And this is where you see some of these weird offshoots of the Izzet deck. So Jacob Nagro posted a list that was essentially this like mid-rangey controlling blue-red deck with Divide by Zero, among other things, and I think leaning into cards like Thing in the Ice, and I know some people were doing the Favor of the Mirror Breaker plus Crackling Drake stuff at one point, and there's a lot of stuff you can do in that space. Lest we forget the Narset plus Day's Undoing or Collective Defiance kind of combo control decks from a while back. So if you want to sleeve up Scene Vents, there's prowess as well. There's a lot of stuff you can do. I think Phoenix will remain the default, but it's not even clear how you're meant to build your Phoenix deck. So if you're someone who's looking to tread new ground in Pioneer, like this family of decks might actually be one of the better places to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it has the best card in the format in Treasure Cruise, and like, I don't know, if we're saying like dicey things about Phoenix and it's not putting up the best results, it's probably time to actually just figure out what you're supposed to be doing with Treasure Cruise, because again, I've yet to see a game where that card resolves out of any reasonable deck that doesn't feel like a giant blowout.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish out our Pioneer discussion then by talking about Greasefang, and specifically Absine Greasefang, because we've kind of gone across the whole color wheel here. We've had Esper Greasefang, we've had Mardu Greasefang, and both of those approaches, to me, look like on paper they should be good and should have staying power, but neither one of them really gained any traction in the format. Absine Greasefang, in its current incarnation, I think was introduced by who else? Jan-Moritz Merkel, crusher of paper magic, online magic on both platforms. So at first you think maybe this is just a JMM doing JMM things situation. But then other people have taken that ball and run with it. And at this point, Absine Greasefang is the most popular approach to Greasefang, and also the first approach to the deck that has actually gained any real staying power and consistency in the format.
Well, I kind of have two issues with this deck, right? So the first issue is the Rakdos deck is putting Unlicensed Hearse in its main deck. Do you actually want to be playing Greasefang right now? Even if that is the case, I think this is actually probably a bigger point about like what the boundaries are on the Pioneer format right now, which is the second biggest deck is Mono Green Ramp. A hallmark of what that deck looks like against Greasefang, against Hidden Strings, I guess a lot of these other decks attempting to be linear, which is why, you know, we've talked about a lot of aggro and mid-range decks. It is very hard for any of these other decks to beat a deck that just has Karn the Great Creator. That card, like,
yes.
It's like, oh, my opponent's best card is like four of Tutor for their best hate card, but also like the Greasefang deck just doesn't function if your opponent controls a Karn. Like, you have to crew a vehicle, doesn't work. I mean, so let's rephrase this, and I think you would have to rethink the whole premise, but something I have pulled off in Mono Green Mirrors is using my Karn to activate my Skyboat to attack their Karn, because you just plus it on the Skyboat and it becomes a creature with some power and toughness. Maybe you could play a Karn Greasefang deck where you're attempting to beat their Karns with your Karns, but I don't think that really works on the same level, because like, what is your Karn doing as the Mono Green deck? Like, I guess they aren't legally allowed to activate the Chain Veil, but that's about it, right?
Yeah, you have the issue that basically any deck does, which is the best draws from mono-green are going to demolish you, and now you introduce this new issue of any draw that produces a turn 3 card is likely to also get the job done as well. That being said, I've come around to thinking that matchup is closer than I assumed at first based on that fact, because firstly, sometimes if you're on the play as Greasefang, like, you can do the Greasefang thing on turn 3 pretty consistently, and if you're on the play, then you're doing that ahead of their Khan, which means their Khan, instead of looking out your Greasefang and then doing other stuff to win the game, now, like, it fetches a Tormod script and it dies on the spot a lot of the time. And you also do have, I think specifically Witherbloom Command is a part of this puzzle, where the fact that that blows up both Warfellow Haven and any of the elves all functions as an enabler at the same time, can let you flip the script on some of the, like, middling mono-green draws. And Witherbloom Command also is a good main deckable answer to Unlicensed Hearse, which then also in post-Cyborg games hits Rest in Peace, hits some of the more narrow answers as well. So I've been pretty impressed by the Greasefang deck's ability to just, like, do its thing and do its thing consistently in the face of removal. You know, can't stay away is a really big part of that equation. And then there have been other backup plans introduced to the deck. So, like, Rotting Registrar is a recent thing where if you want a big thing, which once they kill it the first time, which is not easy to do, right? Like, you play this against Phoenix, they have to spend two removal spells to deal with your six toughness creature, and then you can just can't stay away at back. Like, this is another big thing you can play towards. And it's also a much-needed, frankly, discard outlet for Parhelion, which isn't as mopey as, like, a Raffine's Informant or what have you. So I've been pretty impressed with the deck on the whole, and also I think that a lot of the natural assumptions about, oh, these are the matchups or these are the cards which it hates to see, are kind of more... I don't take this for granted the way that I did a week or two ago.
That's fair. I mean, you're saying that it's possible to win, but are you favored to win? Are you just like, I am finding my way to my 40% instead of my, like, I don't know, I hope their deck falls apart?
The mono-green matchup, honestly, it might be a case of you would rather be the deck on the play than get your choice of deck. I don't think it's quite that far. I think you would still rather be on the mono-green side, but that is more up in the air for me than it was recently.
Okay, that's totally fair. So, I guess to tie a bow on that, I think that my suggestions for this format are mono-green or Boros Heroic. What decks would you suggest from this pile?
I would, you know, echo both of those, and then I think Absent Greasefang, I won't call it a wild card because it has proven results at this point, but I need to get a few more reps in with it before I'd be comfortable myself. The one thing that we did mention in all of this is the control decks, right? Like, Blue-White Control is still doing pretty well on Modo, and decks like that will always have a certain following. Like, I'm sure that if I see Shaheen in Baltimore, like, his Pioneer Seat, if it's him, will be playing a deck like that. So, and there's other stuff on the fringes. I know the latest Aspiring Spike brew was like a Magma Opus, Torrential Gearhulk, Indomitable Creativity deck that looked really cool, but as always with these decks, you don't know if it's a flash in the pan. But I think that, yeah, I would echo Mono Green Devotion, potentially with a Black Splash, and then Heroic, and then potentially Greasefang, you know, but check back with me on that in a day or two.
Okay. That sounds like you have endorsed most of everything, but also, like, pay more attention to the couple of decks that we talked about that you haven't endorsed.
Yeah, I could see myself endorsing, like, either of the Humans decks in a day from now and potentially sweeping them out myself, but that's just a case of, like, I haven't got to that point in my preparation yet, and, you know, I don't want to endorse those too much ahead of time. Let's move ahead to Legacy, then, to round this out, where I think the story... Like, in one sense, the story of Legacy has not changed in, like, 8 years at this point. Delver is the best deck. You should probably play Delver. A lot of people will play Delver. It is the biggest and maybe only limit test for any deck that you're considering for this tournament. And frankly, your deck is probably worse at passing that test than you think it is.
Yeah, that's kind of been the impression that I got, is especially over the last, like, year or so, really since Modern Horizons 2, a lot of decks that have traditionally kept up with Delver just aren't anymore. Death and Taxes being a pretty big one that I now hear a lot of rumblings about, like, well, I can't play Taxes because the Delver matchup is bad. It's like, well, then what is Taxes doing?
Yeah, I have fumbled a lot of predictions or calls in my time, and you can hear me doing that on this very podcast every week. But one call that I made that I'm happy with, and that was frankly very easy to make and should have been easier for more people, is that the Ragavan ban, when it happened, was not going to solve any of the underlying problems. Because if you look at the structure of the Delver decks at this point, over the years, they have become the best in their class at basically every facet of the game. You know, they have the best threats, they have the best card advantage, best card filtering, best interaction. They can operate very well on low resources, but then also win these longer games as well. Almost any requirement that you would have for a deck, the Delver deck ticks that box better than most of its competition. And so with the threats in particular, you can go back past Ragavan. You can look at Dreadhold Arcanist and Oko. You can look at Renin 6 and then Deathrite Shaman, and just all of these cards, like every other card on the Legacy ban list is a threat from the Delver deck. And then the others in between are like Zerda or Lurrus or what have you. And just this like whack-a-mole approach with the threats, it is a very temporary healing salve on one of those issues, but it doesn't touch all of the other issues that go into making the Delver deck the menace on the format that it has been for years at this point.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, Deathrite Shaman, I think we've discussed in reasonable detail, and I think that card goes beyond it, but like a lot of the other stuff is just like, what is the most impactful Delver card we can ban without feeling like we're offending the Delver players? And I don't know, that's some sketchy ground to keep treading. Like, maybe the first two times it happens, but the third time you might need to go a little bigger.
Worth noting that for as much as we talk about Delver, there is a branch of this archetype that does not even play that card anymore. So Isaac Bullwinkle, a noted Legacy Zuma expert, has penned this treatise, which goes in depth on like the theory behind Delver and why the card Delver itself like removes some of the versatility from the deck and so on. And he and some of his companions, I guess, have been putting up good results with this more mid-rangey approach, which they would bristle at that description, but I'm going to go full Cedric here. This deck isn't mid-range, and I will hear nothing to the contrary. And I think that is caught on online a little bit, and in some pockets in paper, but I would expect, you know, in Baltimore, most of the people on an Is It strategy to be in the Is It Delver camp still, and but just be aware of that that possibility. And then I think that, like, when you look at the matchups that other decks have against Delver, one issue is that Delver can accommodate and find its sideboard cards better than basically any other deck. And so there was a window where, for example, Canister won the Mox playoff for Legacy on Modo by playing Reanimator. And that was a very smart call for that field, because the Izzet decks at that time didn't have much graveyard hate and were pretty light on Force Negation. And so you could kind of drive a wedge through that weakness in the format. But once that becomes a known quantity, if the Delver decks next week decide to show up with hard graveyard hate and more Force Negations, well, that matchup no longer looks as peachy anymore. And so isolating the true matchup there is pretty difficult. I would say the one strategy which has shown good results against Delver, kind of regardless of what's going on there, is Green-White Depths. So this is a personal favorite of mine, and a deck which it is quite reminiscent of, you know, Amulet Titan or some of these like very toolboxy creature combo decks in other formats, where you have Elvish Reclaimer, Crop Rotation, Knight of the Reliquary, giving you very consistent access to basically any land in your deck, and then the two creatures there are also substantial threats in their own right. You very easily can get a 3/4 Elvish Reclaimer or a 8/8 Knight of the Reliquary backed up by Sylvan Safekeeper off Green Sun Zenith, which offers this additional toolbox, giving you protection as well. And then you just have the good cheap removal so in Source of Plowshares. You have a lot of the just generic good cards in that space. And so that deck naturally lines up quite well against Delver in a way that it's pretty hard for the Delver decks to adjust to. So they can play more Submerges, they can play more Dismembers or Blood Moon, stuff like that, but none of that really fixes the underlying issue. But then the downside there is you have this glaring weakness to some of the combo decks in the format. And so like Elves is like a pretty horrific matchup for Depths, and that deck is pretty popular online, or stuff like, you know, Storm or, God forbid, Doomsday, which this is a pretty good illustration of the whole dynamic of the format. You look at these matchup data matrices or whatever, and Doomsday just dunks hard on every deck other than Delver, but it's still a fringe player in the format because it's 35%, you know, win rate against Delver just consigned it to the dustbin until something changes there.
Yeah, so I guess this is all coming back to, like, what do you think even the potential exploits are for Delver out of the sort of combo tier? Like, if Doomsday is not the answer, and, like, Reanimator isn't the answer, which decks are actually play? I mean, is the answer just, like, play Depths because you'll beat all the people who are on Delver later in the day, and you hope your other two teammates carry you through, like, random Oops All Spells player in the first four rounds? Or, like, because that's what it sounds like you're saying here, especially in a team event.
There's this kind of frustrating discontinuity between, like, paper legacy and online legacy, and then within online legacy, between the kind of serious legacy tournaments and just the challenges, or God forbid, the leagues, which are just this, like, wasteland full of random combo decks, where, you know, I've often made these, like, metagame calls for online legacy events, trying to target the Delver decks, and feeling like my deck does that successfully, but then you queue into Reanimator and Doomsday, or, like, Elves and Storm or something, and that doesn't... It feels like you kind of got punked out of the tournament, but in a way which is predictable in one sense, because it happens so much, given just the dynamics going on in the format there. And this is the issue, really, is that there are more strategies which I think are or could be sound against Delver, but they just get policed by everything at the extremes of the format, and Delver is a thing which kind of intrinsically has the most broad play against all of those stuff at the same time without needing to care as much.
Yeah, it's... I don't know what the right answer is besides, like, play Delver. I also think this is a good spot for me to, like, go on my rant of, like, be less scared about playing mirrors against good players, because there's a chance for you to make all the same good plays as well. It is easier than you think to put up a good fight in those matchups, and given the stability of, like, the legacy format as a whole, I think it is unlikely that your opponent will show up with some groundbreaking tech, and you'll just be playing the same cards against them, and, like, there's a lot of ways out of that, I think.
Yeah, the best way to overcome your fear of playing mirrors is to actually suck it up and play some mirrors, and also, one of the better ways to improve as a Magic player is to play intricate mirrors against other good players, or even if you don't consider yourself a good player yet, like, that's how you level up, is by seeing why you're losing in those spots and, like, internalizing those lessons. And if you're trying to do that, the legacy Delver mirror might be the perfect matchup to showcase some of those skills, where I think it's more akin to, like, chess or to some more kind of a tactical game than most mirrors across most formats, honestly. Like, if you want, you know, if you had to put up a human champion against, you know, an alien civilization with humanity on the line, like, you would probably want to give John Finkel a legacy Delver deck or whatever, because that's how I think you could maximize the level of agency in that game.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. Saying chess is daunting. I mean, it is still fundamental Magic, and a lot of, you can just kind of, like, generate some pretty good heuristics and just, like, try and work your way around those. Maybe you'll stumble into something weird with, like, some crazy Daze setup that you have never imagined, but I think that a lot of the problems that people run into in those matchups is not setting themselves up with, like, a basic level one attempt to, like, go for what the good plays are, and not, like, these level two, level three workarounds. Maybe that only describes, like, 70% of the games, but that's a lot of them.
Yeah, so in the same space as Depths, you also have Lands, which we alluded to a bit before, and which I think is still good against Izzet, especially now that a lot of them are shaving or cutting Price of Progress entirely, mainly because it is really only good against exactly Lands. The issue there is that, so you're a bit better against the control decks of the format. You're still just as weak to combo, and in the, like, Lands deck mirror against White-Green Depth, White-Green just has a gigantic advantage there. So it still has pretty polarized matchups. You're just changing what some of those matchups are. And then looking further afield, there are a lot of decks which their pilots claim are good against Delver, but if you look at the data and also just the theory and the lived experience, like, that isn't really borne out. So Elves would be the perfect example. This is a deck which is meant to be very good against Delver. You look at the online data, not good against Delver, or really against anything else. Like, it's not boasting a good win percentage across the board, outside of the two or three people who play Elves in every event, are masters with the deck, and if anything, artificially inflating its win rate in the process there.
Yeah, I was going to say, Elves is the other deck that comes to mind when I said, like, Taxes is now bad against Delver. Like, this is the deck that has slowly had its win percentage crumble. I guess the third deck, and we'll jump over to a different category of decks, is probably 8-cast. Because I know that was, like, a very contentious topic of all the 8-cast players being like, oh, the Delver matchup's unlosable. And the Delver players that were good being like, yeah, it's about 50-50. And I think the data has slowly borne out that, like, no, the Delver players actually have figured it out, and, like, 8-cast is not great anymore. But we also have seen a lot of, like, on the other side of things, like, Red Prison and Painter decks do well recently.
Yeah, 8-cast is the deck I've been playing in Paper Legacy for the past few months, and more out of a sense of, like, this is the deck I own than because I think it's the best deck or even just, like, a solid deck. I think it has some pretty big structural weaknesses. But against Delver, like, it's not a great matchup. You can definitely steal games, and I think game one in particular, it's probably slightly favored for 8-cast. But, like, the fact that these decks can just consistently find and protect a meltdown against you, and all the decks have at least one to two meltdowns now. Like, that is just a stock part of every Izzet sideboard. You could really get them good in the first weeks of, like, Kamigawa Neon Dynasty. And I remember, like, Helen Pastora winning a Legacy event with Affinity during that time. Those three wins are not really on the table anymore. That being said, I think, you know, having been in the trenches with this deck now, there are ways you can make that matchup better. First of all, play 17 lands, because you're in this weird spot where, like, you have a ton of mana sources in your deck, but a lot of those are conditional. They're Mox Opals and Lotus Petals. So you end up being susceptible to flooding in the sense of you draw too many of these, and then some of these are only temporary. But then also, your actual land count is pretty low, and so it's easy for you to just get wastelanded out of a game for no good reason. So playing like a second Otobara or something can help to mitigate that. And then also, I think 4 Flusterstorm in the sideboard is a pretty important development too, where this is your best response to meltdown and just in general to interaction from the Delver decks, which is also, like, weirdly good elsewhere too. So it's as good as you would think against most of the combo decks, but even against, like, white green death, for example. Like, this is a matchup where they're trying to access Collect Oof via Green Sun Zenith, and they're going to be showing up with Pyroblast, Force of Vigor after sideboarding. You can catch a Crop Rotation, Source of Plowshares, Pyroblast. Like, you look at this deck, which is this, like, land toolbox deck and a creature toolbox deck, but the most important parts are the spells. And so if you look at how the decks are trying to beat you, you find a lot of spots where Flusterstorm is, like, weirdly better than you think it would be.
That all checks out to me. Do you have any thoughts on the other side of the aisle with these red decks and, like, what's going on with them? Or is it just, like, the same thing we've always seen with the red Stompy deck, where people just kind of, like, show up and tap their Ancient Tombs or, like, whatever's going on with Painter when Delver is very good because you get to play main deck Pyroblast?
So the red Stompy decks went through this interesting evolution where for most of the last year, they were just kind of a joke in the face of specifically Ragavan, where that card is amazing against Blood Moon and also pretty good against, like, Trinisphere or Taxing Effects or stuff like that. And just in general, I think the limits of that strategy where you're effectively, it's kind of what people used to say about Eldrazi Tron, right? Like, you're 4 Chalice of the Void and 4 whatever other card is relevant, and then 50-something other cards. That is no longer true. I think this deck has seen some pretty massive upgrades in recent sets. So Fable of the Mirror Breaker is a pretty big one, where this is a 3-drop which fills the role of if you cheat this out on turn 1 or turn 2 and it's uncontested, then it's going to create this cascading advantage over time, but also it's going to fix your draw. It's going to turn that useless Blood Moon or a Chalice into another threat or another lock piece potentially. And then Unlicensed Hearse is another one as well, where this card is phenomenal against any of the graveyard decks, also very good against Delver, and you can cast this cleanly off an Ancient Tomb, off a City of Traders on turn 1, works with your other threats at the same time. Fury, a big thing too, where, you know, these decks had Pyrokinesis in the past. This is a Pyrokinesis which you can just cast as a big threat in longer games, or pull the trigger on the first turn on the stuff that snuck under your Chalice of the Void. So just so many upgrades across the board for this deck. And so this is a deck now which is, it has all of those free wins that it had in the past, but is also just quite fundamentally solid in a way that it never has been in the past.
Yeah, I think that also, like, if you look at the threat bases, like, condensing everything down to three mana really helps. I know there were a lot of past lists that were just, like, I don't know. I'm thinking back to, like, the history of, like, Rakdos Pit Dragon and, like, Hazoret the Fervent, where you're just like, I sure hope I get another turn after my, like, initial lock piece where I get to, like, play, you know, I've used, like, Ancient Tomb and Simeon Spirit Guide, and now I need to, like, hit two more mana sources, and then the Rakdos Pit Dragon's online. And now there's just this, like, overload of good three drops. It's like, I'm looking through lists, and it's like, okay, well, there's Angie's Ravager and Lelia, but also, like, every list has, like, Rabble Master and Legion War Boss and Fable. Like, their whole deck is just costed to, like, play a hate card on turn one, play a good threat on turn two. And I think that just, like, crunching everything down into that time span is a pretty big improvement.
God, Rakdos Pit Dragon. I remember 15 years ago when the deck was called Dragon Zombie, because this was one of the hallmark threats of the deck, and you know, it made sense, I guess, in those simpler times to name the deck after it. But now, thankfully, we have more options available to us.
Yeah, I'm just going to read the text of this card for everyone who will be left wondering how Legacy was once like this. 2 red red 3/3, pay red red, it gets flying until end of turn. Pay a red, it gets +1/+0 until end of turn, and if you have no cards in hand, it has double strike. So this is actually just, like, more than a trained Armadon. It just is a 4-mana 3/3 that you can maybe pay mana to do things with. And that was a Legacy staple.
But back then, all of the log pieces, effectively, were the same. You still had Blood Moon and Makers of the Moon, you still had Chalice of the Void and Trinisphere, and if anything, this is a perfect encapsulation of the history of Magic. It's that, for so long, the cards that said, fuck you, you don't get to play the game anymore, those were early printings, early stars, and those were all still good. And thankfully, they hadn't printed that many more of those. It's just that the creatures that we get to play with in 2022 are a massive upgrade from the threats that we got to play with in 2007.
Yeah. We've come a long way from that card. So we've talked about the lock decks. What else is there to talk about besides, like, the combo decks we're not very high on? Delver, which obviously is a great choice. Silesnia Depths, which sounds great. I guess you've listed Tundra decks. That encompasses a lot of stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there are lots of people who like playing Tundra decks, and so they have a vast breadth of options to choose between, including one very unique Tundra deck that we will get to in Nonsense of the Week. But so you have, like, Jeskai Control, which has been doing pretty well, and this can span the full range from, like, Wrath of Tapper style pure control, where you're winning with a Timeless Dragon and a Shark Typhoon, of course, or it can be these combo control style decks where the Jeskai Wheels deck with Narset into Day's Undoing, your Hull Breacher into Day's Undoing, that was one of the stars of the format a few months ago. So there's a lot of, you know, if you want to sleeve up Tundra, there are a ton of ways you can do it, and there is a pretty big constituency that looks for any excuse to sleeve up Tundra. And those decks, if you build them with discipline, I think are pretty good against Izzet. It's just a case of, you know, there's a thing with these decks just across all formats of, you, in theory, you have the tools against everything, but actually putting that into practice can be easier said than done sometimes. And so these decks look better on paper than they tend to perform, but right now they're still performing pretty well. So if you want to sleeve up, you know, Tundra and Swords of Plowshares, that's not just copium at this point. You can do that and feel pretty happy about it.
I would like to make a slight counter-argument that you have described a lot of cards that cost 3 and 4 mana against the 4 days and all one drops deck. So I am much more of a skeptic than you are here.
Yeah, well, that was the issue with, like, the Wheels deck in particular, is it was a 3-drop tribal deck a la Rakdos and Pioneer, but without any of the Ancient Tombs and Sibian Spirit Guides that power the 3-drop tribal deck in this format. But if you build your Jeskai deck with a more reasonable number of 3-drops, and you still load up on, you know, Sword, Prismatic Ending, Pyroblast, you back it up with the usual package of Brainstorms, Expeditive Iterations, that is a good formula for for keeping the Delver decks in check, and it almost... It doesn't really matter past a certain point what the top-end stuff is, because you don't really expect it to resolve against Delver, and you're expecting to shave on some amount of that stuff regardless.
Yeah, I mean, are we counting the, like, Esper Sentinel Delver deck as a Tundra deck here, or is that its own thing?
That is its own thing, but I'm not sure that it is a thing. I think this is that specific player, True Hero, just doing their thing and winning yet another challenge with a very personal deck, which I would not endorse to anyone else.
Well, maybe we can jump into some of those decks that are less endorsable. Are there any other, like, primary decks you want to talk about, or is it time to start talking about the fun of one-ohs?
Yes, I'd flag up Death Shadow, because this had a brief moment in the sun, winning a few challenges, and seeming like it would be a good alternative, like, tempo option to Delver in the format. I don't think that the Delver matchup itself is actually as good as advertised, and I think you are a little weaker against stuff like Deaths or the Tundra decks and so on, so I don't know if that trade-off is worth it in the end. But yeah, let's get into nonsense of the week, and we have a broad buffet of nonsense across all three of the formats that we're highlighting today.
Yeah, I mean, there were decks that we had not even included in nonsense that are, like, technically on the legacy list, like Hammer Time and, like, this Thoughtlash deck, but we're going to go deeper than that.
Honestly, if you're looking for an accessible route into Legacy and you have a modern collection or you've been playing modern, Hammer Time might be the best answer for you. You take your Hammer Time deck, I guess you buy your Mox Opals, which is easier to do now because you can't play this in modern, sadly, and you buy your Ancient Dens, and you're basically good to go there.
Yeah, the deck has been winning way too much for it not to be, like, it's more than a joke, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if it's not a joke, but it's not a joke either, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say that, like, we went through this whole discussion of, like, well, you're going to play against Meltdown every round and then play this deck into Meltdown, but, like, you could do worse.
Yeah. So let's talk about our actual nonsense here. And we'll start with, I guess, the most tame of these decks in Pioneer. And this is an old favorite with some recent upgrades. This is Possibility Storm. So this was one of the more eye-catching Pioneer decks back at the very start of the format, where the gimmick was you would have Possibility Storm, which effectively, whenever a player casts a spell, that spell gets eaten, and they get to cascade into a spell that shares a card type with it and play that spell. So what we're doing here is we're pairing that with the adventure cards, which are technically creatures, but you can cast them as instant or sorceries. So if you have, let's say, a Lovestruck Beast with a Possibility Storm out, you play the one mana half of that card, you play the Heart's Desire, you flip that into the next sorcery in your deck, which happens to be Enter the Infinite, so you draw the entire rest of your deck, you get to put a card back, and then you play a zero-cost creature, in this case Stonecaller Servant, you flip that into Borborygmos Enrage, and then fling all of the lands from your deck at the opponent to win the game in true style that way. So that was a really fun concept at the time, not a competitive one necessarily, and has not aged all that well. But the recent addition here in this list is the Learn mechanic from Strixhaven, where it's another way of taking one card type and using it to access cards with a different card type. So we have, like, Gnarled Professor in this deck, which is a creature, but it can grab an instant or sorcery from our sideboard, or you can turn an instant into a sorcery, or vice versa. So there are a lot of ways to kind of dodge that restriction there.
Can you explain to me why there's a first day of class to add a second... Oh, I guess it's an instant. Never mind. My bad on what that does.
Yeah, I think it's just an instant that has the word learn on it.
Okay.
But sometimes you chain this into a 6/6 love shock with haste and get scrappy.
Okay, yeah, that also makes sense, because I think one of the previous issues was, like, the best adventure was Bonecrusher Giant, and this allows you to flip Bonecrusher Giant into a... what's it called? Environmental Sciences out of your sideboard into the Edge of the Infinite. That's the chain. You know what? This is the first time I've ever noticed that first day of class was an instant, because it's just the kind of card that you cast on your turn on your main phase.
Yeah, to set up your Empty the Barons or your Goblin combo loop in Pauper, which is a thing. But yeah, nice to find yet another silly use for that card. So really cool deck across the board, but not too much else to say about it. And then we get to Modern.
Yeah, so I believe last week we said new four-color deck dropped, and then dropped, what was it, Karth the Lion? This week's a little more Just a little more. This is Omnath color, four color, so we're back to normal, and there's even Omnath in the deck. And there's Renin 6 and Teferi Time Raveler, and I think that's about where the normal ends.
Would you describe this as four color Omnath?
There might be other words required to describe this, but yes, this is a four color Omnath subvariant.
Yeah, this was one of the, to date this episode a little bit, this was one of the latest rounds of Twitter discourse is Frank Carson asking, for the sake of his new column, which has come back, what do I call the different four-color piles in Modern? How do we differentiate between them? Do we call it four-color Omnath, four-color Control, four-color Elementals, what have you? And this is as big of a middle finger to any sensible naming convention as I can possibly imagine.
Yeah, so this is, it's got Raghavan. Okay, that does not give you any indication of where the rest of this is going. It's got Noble Hierarch, also no indication. And it's got a third color of one drop in Esper Sentinel, which might give you a little bigger hint. Because this is, well, you see, there are four Colossus Hammers in your deck, and that's one for each of Omnath's hands. I don't know what they're going to do when five-color Omnath comes around.
So the goal here is to make a 44-44 Omnath just wielding like quad laser Colossus Hammers?
Yeah, exactly. That is entirely the goal of this deck.
Yeah, so this is a four-color Hammer or four-color Control or what have you at the same time. I don't know if this quite qualifies as just playing the good cards. Maybe Alan Wu would have something to say on that.
Yeah, I mean, the Urza Sagas in your 19-land deck with Omnath are really the piece that sort of gives away that I don't want to say you're not even trying, but, like, something's going on. I do like the application of, like, admitting that you can't really cast Pure Steel Paladin off this mana, so you're moving towards, like, three of those and a Magnetic Theft.
Oh, yeah. The number of three offs in this deck is something to behold. So, three Sagada's Aid as well, which, really, that's a card which you know you want four of, or you wouldn't even consider playing the first copy of. So to see exactly three in your city card deck is a statement of sorts, I suppose. But what I think what you're really missing with Urza Saga is this is a rainbow land, because when it pops off on turn three, turn four, it's finding Springleaf Drum, which can then be the bridge to Omnath. This actually sets up a turn three Omnath, potentially, in a way that a few other cards really can.
Yeah, that's that is certainly one thing that you are allowed to do with that. I like that they also found room for a Boseiju. Like, the mana is just horrific, but we found room for the Boseiju.
Yeah, there's a lot of like random stuff going on. So you look over at the sideboard, it's entirely runoffs, 15 runoffs. And so your first thought is, okay, well, some of these are going to be bullets for Urza Saga, or we have Stoneforge Mystics, and maybe there'll be some one-off equipment that we can find. There's like a sub-amount of all of that going on. But there's also just, hey, we have a Meddling Mage, we have a Lavinia, we have a Prismatic Ending, and yeah, but we're not using Eladamri's Call or Traverse or anything like these normie four color decks to set this up. We're just going to draw these some amount of the time and be okay with it.
This kind of reminds me, there was a discussion about like what was your favorite sideboard of all time, and someone linked the Nassif Legacy sideboard from GP Chicago 2009, which is just like, if I remember correctly, it was like a pretty much tutorless countertop deck that just had 15 cards on the sideboard that all had different names.
Yeah, because why not? And here, you know, we're not saying this is four-color Hammer brackets Yorion or brackets, I guess it couldn't be Kahira or anything else. This is a 60-card deck, and it makes me wonder if this is a 60-card version, what on God's green earth would the 80-card version look like here? I guess it might have the fourth Pure Steel Paladin. Maybe we can find room for that finally.
Yeah.
Or the fourth Renin 6.
There's a lot of three ofs, and you are probably short enough lands that you could just add all those cards to your deck and call it an 80-card deck, but that might be less fun.
Yeah, that gets you to like 71 cards, and then I all bets are off as to what those remaining cards would be.
Yeah, I'm now trying to, this broke me and this Nassif reference happened. I'm trying to figure out if those two 15 card sideboards are 15 different cards between the two of them. Is there a Brenton Forgetender in this one? Ooh, it might actually be two unique 15 cards somehow.
I would have to pin my hopes there on the Gaddock Teeg.
Relic of Progenitus is the overlap. There we go.
Hell yeah. There we go. And yet, somehow, this is not the most absurd four-color deck in this segment this week.
Yeah, somehow, despite being we spent all this time talking about every format that is not Modern, we are spending all this time talking about four-color decks because CFT Sock won the Legacy MOCS qualifier with 4-color, but, like, it's almost mono-green 4-color? I mean, this is, like, mono-green 4-color from Pioneer, right?
Yeah, so this is, like, with a 5-color hammer deck, it's, okay, this is really cool that this 5 out of league, so that we get to feature it in the segment and it's introduced to the world, but we're not expected to 5-0 many more leagues in the near future. This is not 5-0-ing a league. This is winning the most competitive Legacy tournament on Magic Online with a brew of your own creation, which itself has both some of the signature CFT Sock moves that any fan of theirs, and everyone should be a fan of theirs, would recognize, but also just some crazy off-the-wall stuff, which, like, when you think about it, makes sense, and it seems kind of genius, but I don't know how many people would arrive at these conclusions on their own either.
I have gone straight to the source and, like, am reading the tweets. I like how he casually, like, there's just this discussion of, like, the Spellseeker endgame. What is the Spellseeker endgame? Is it just, like, finding the instance?
Okay.
Yeah, talk me through this.
All right, so the tagline for this deck is, this is, I guess, 5-color Spellseeker Ephemerate combo, brackets, Yorion. And that part, by the way, the brackets, Yorion, that is contingent. There was a time where this was just a 67-card deck, 68-card deck out in the wild, existing in that beautiful liminal space between 60 and 80 cards. But eventually, CFT Sock kind of came back to Earth, I suppose, and just went up to the full 80 and added Yorion. But the idea here is, this is an Ephemerate deck, and we're pairing it with Spellseeker. So this is a 2 and a blue card, I want to say from Battle Bond initially, or one of the supplementary sets, which, still not quite sure on how they, along with, like, stickers and everything else, just get smuggled into Legacy by default, but here we are, and we get this result because of that, so got to be thankful for it. So it's 2 and a blue, 1-1, when it ETBs, you search your library for an instant or sorcery with mana value 2 or less and put it into your hand. So it's kind of the Recruiter of the Guard equivalent, if you like, for spells. And so this is a self-contained engine in the sense of Spellseeker can find Ephemerate. You can then Ephemerate Spellseeker to find, if it works, 2 more instant or sorceries, and then go from there. And so in this toolbox, we have your Brainstorm and Ponder, which you're going to play in your Legacy Blue deck, and those, I guess, count as part of the toolbox. This is also a Green Sun Zenith deck. So Zenith costs X and G. So its sticker price is 1, sticker price, which means that you can Spellseeker for that and then cast it for whatever value you want to unlock one of these other green creatures in this, like, separate toolbox that exists in the deck. And then, so we'll come back to that part in a second. The other spells you can get here, we got Swords of Plowshares, so that's going to be a nice one to find. Prismatic Ending when you need more versatile removal. We have a main deck Pyroblast and a main deck Hydroblast, which in an is it format is both of those can do some good work. We have one Expressive Iteration, because sometimes you need a more hefty card draw spell. We have a Traverse the Uvenwald as another tutor for all of these other creatures in the deck, including a second copy of Spellseeker if something bad just happened to the first one. And then the thing that is the end game we're all playing towards here is Orym's Chant, because this is, again, a fine card to draw against many of the combo decks in the format, but also in conjunction with Eternal Witness, which is the other half of this Ephemerate like payoff chain, you can set up this Orym's Chant lock where you Ephemerate back, or you Eternal Witness back the Ephemerate and the Orym's Chant in every turn cycle, and then Orym's Chant on their upkeep. So this is white, your opponent can't cast spells this turn, and then kicker for white, they also can't attack this turn. So you can lock them out of casting any non-instant spells or really participating in the game at all, and you can use Spellseeker as this, like, one card combo to set this incredibly elaborate chain in motion to get all of this together. And then the Green Sun Zenith angle here, that can find you Eternal Winners, of course, but it can also find you any of the following. So, deep breath. Dryad Arbor, naturally. Birds of Paradise, sure. One Iceland Cradle, which sometimes you want this cheap Ephemerate thing to target, that's fine. 4 main deck Endurance, this is part of the recipe against both Delver and the Graveyard combo decks. 3 Uro, we've seen that before, great. 2 Eternal Winners, and then Knight of Autumn, a Grist the Hungertide, which is a good card to have in any Z in the toolbox. And then the real kicker here is 1 Hornet Queen, because in this deck, which is generating obscene amounts of mana via Carpenter Flowers, which we have four in the 95, and three of those are in the main deck, which is a bold statement about the shape of the format here. And Carpenter Flowers, so again, we'll list off the text here for the unfamiliar. This is G for an enchantment. At the beginning of each of your main phases, so you can play this on main phase one and trigger it again on main phase two if you haven't already. If you haven't used this effect this turn yet, you add X mana to your mana pool in color of your choice, where X is the number of islands your opponents control. So you can imagine how incredible of a ramp spell that is against, and every turn, by the way, against, you know, Delver or some of the blue decks of the format. If Carpenter Flowers has text in the matchup, it is one of the best cards in all of Legacy, and enough of those matchups exist that you can justify main decking three copies of that card with the fourth in the sideboard there and expect to get good value out of them. And so once you're making all of this amount of mana, then you want a big thing in your Zenith toolbox to play towards, and Hornet Queen is lights out against Delver if you get there. And so the choice of Hornet Queen over like Primeval Titan for Field of the Dead or any of the number of other options, this is a statement that, again, we are targeting the Delver matchup here and taking the steps that we need to take in order to beat that, and apparently it paid off in this tournament.
Yeah, I think that you buried one lead here, which is that the Greens and Zenith can find the Birds of Paradise that is in the sideboard.
Yes.
Again, to read off the tweets by the tournament winner, re-sideboard Burb. Please do not disturb the Burb in the sideboard. He is simply taking a little nap before he is ready to enter the deck. Apparently, the real reason is that when Carpet is not a good card, you can board in a bird and sort of, like, hedge your ramp. But, like, I think that that's just, like, really absurd in terms of, like, what's going on here. The sideboard is a delight besides that as well.
Oh, yeah. So, if you've played any modern four-color members recently, you will be very familiar with the looming threat of Emrakul the Promised End and how that is the unbeatable endgame in these mirrors and how the entire game effectively is sculpting this race towards that card. It's very rare that you see that in Legacy, and for good reason, but with this deck, we have one copy of Emrakul that we can Spellseeker for Traverse for in these longer games, and that is the thing that is going to bust open any of these like Jeskai matchups or these other Bant Uro decks or what have you. Those decks not beating an Emrakul anytime soon. So we have all of that. We also have more cards for both of our toolboxes. So for Zenith, we have the one Collect Oof, the one Gaddock Teague, that makes sense. And then the much maligned Birds of Paradise, which it makes a lot more sense to me, actually, because I think it's a very underutilized tactic where, like, your deck is built around this expectation of some amount of the time, I'm going to be using this jump ahead in mana, but if Carpet doesn't have text, I'm not going to have access to that. What other ways do I have to unlock that effect? And, you know, having this thing that I can Zenith for that is itself a ramp spot is the best way to square that circle, even if, like, one sideboard Birds of Paradise looks very out of place at first glance. But to then pivot to the Spellseeker toolbox, we have a Nature's Claim, a Surgical Extraction, which, you know, we can Spellseeker for that on turn one, or turn two, turn three, and then immediately cast it if we need it. Two more Pyroblasts, two Spell Pierces, those make sense. And then two copies of Sudden Demise. So this is another one of these like supplementary product cards that you probably may not have seen before. This is X and a red. You choose a color, and all, I'll check if it's ground creatures or all creatures, just take X damage of that color. And yeah, it's each creature, so no like earthquake style flying restriction. So this is a really nice thing to be able to Spellseeker for against, let's say, elves or death and taxes or any of the like mono X creature decks that happen to exist in this format. Hey, you get paired against the mono red prison deck, you Spellseeker for Sudden Demise, and then that deals with all of the goblin tokens and fables and fable tokens and so on, and that's a nice angle to have access to as well. That is also searchable with your Spellseeker in a way that no other sweeper is, effectively. So there is so much going on here, and hey, if this was just a deck from a stranger in the 5-0 decklist dump and we were talking about Legacy this week, this is one of the decks I would feature. But the fact that it's I won't say friend of the show, I don't know if they're even aware of our existence, but CFT Sock, who I have you know, talked about my fandom of many times here in the past and will continue to do so now, the fact that it's them winning the Legacy Showcase with this deck that they have been iterating on over and over the past few months, I mean, it's beautiful. You really do love to see it.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where, like, it's always great to see, you know, like when Lantern won its like first major event, or like when Scred Red won a Grand Prix. Like, this is in the same kind of boat of like, this is awesome. This is why people play Magic, is because this kind of stuff can happen. And I'm sorry, I just realized now that there's a Bayou in this deck to, I guess, hard cast Surgical Extraction and extend your Prismatic Ending.
Well, we need to cast the Grist.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, gotta cast the Grist. Yep.
No, sometimes, okay, we the Birds of Paradise won't be online, and maybe it's a bad matchup for Carpenter Flowers, and we haven't drawn an Abundant Growth, so we do need to have the one fetchable black source in our 80-card deck, so that if we draw the other one-off, like the literal one-off in the deck that requires black mana, that we get to actually meet that requirement.
Yes, that is all true.
So, the fun, like, epilogue to all of this is that when you see this, if you are a legacy content creator, if you're making legacy videos for your YouTube channel, for example, of course you're going to play this deck and take it through a league, right? But the problem is you are not CFTSOG and you haven't been deep in the weeds on whatever substances are involved on this deck for the past 8 months. And so watching people try to sight read this deck, as Jarvis put it, as he stumbled through this himself, that itself is also a sight to behold as well.
Yeah, this deck... it's got a lot going on. I keep noticing more things the more I look at it. Like, the fact that your deck is a ton of creatures and, like, enchantments for your Uros, and, like, you will probably be pulling the Abundant Growth My Fetch Land play a lot more than I would imagine anyone does the first time they play this deck. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's, you have one Traverse in an 80-card deck, and so... In theory, you have to be conscious of Delirium, but, like, can you actually justify making sacrifices in order to play towards Delirium? I'm not quite sure about that. And then, you have players who are picking this deck out themselves. Sometimes, those players will queue into each other. And so, I have seen several matches on stream of players who clearly are new to this deck and picking it up and run into the mirror and have no idea what to do. And also... no idea how to finish a match without one player at least being at risk of timing out. So that's, you know, if you missed that from the modern four-color experience, then you can replicate that here in Legacy with this deck as well.
Yeah, the four endurances against the mirror match where graveyards are probably the most important thing to be doing does tend to make this look like a real barn burner.
Yeah, I don't know, like, what the pros and cons are playing this in paper versus on Modo, but having to... manually click through like many turns of an Orym's Charm, Eternal Witness, Ephemerate Loop. Like, you have to hope your opponent is operating under Marcus of Queensbury rules, or is trying to be understanding. Because if they make you click through it, then you're going to have some sore fingers by the end of it.
Maybe cutting the fourth Ponder is a concession to how many times you can click the shuffle button.
Yeah, CFT had some theoretical explanation of how like. Cantrips get worse in a deck like this, especially when you're moving towards 80 cards, and all of that may be true, hard to say. But there's also the fact of, like, you don't want to have to pick up those 80 cards and start shuffling them yet again.
Yeah, this is a great way to end Nonsense of the Week, because we rarely talk about a Nonsense of the Week deck that is, like, a full-on tournament winner, and it is a delight to see something in that space.
I mean, hey, if we didn't have a topic for this week, I would quite happily have just spent an entire episode on this one deck list and this one result, but I'm glad that we got to weave this in with everything else, and I think it's a very fitting conclusion to this episode. So we will let you all get out of here. I'm on Twitter, of course, at Domin Javier. He's at ARMLX, excuse me. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find it on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominarius_judgment. You can find us writing every week on SCG for me, TCG Player for Ari. You can check out my article on essentially this topic of, you know, looking over recent developments in all of these formats ahead of Baltimore. And I think that's going to do it, unless you have anything else.
Nope, that's about it. Good luck in Baltimore, Dom. I unfortunately had prior commitments that have resulted in me turning down a team and then not finding another one. So I will probably not be there, but I expect to hear wonderful stories about your exploits in that city.
I will do my best to bully Jarvis into shape ahead of this this engagement here. So we'll see how all of that plays out. And I will be back next week with an update on that. And we will be back with, I assume, a topic with a more narrow and specific focus, but nice to spread our wings occasionally. So we will be back with that next week. And until then, take care, everyone.